waited until I had at least one look, you wimpy thing. Sally spent the night in Irene's guest room, but she hardly slept at all. Her weeping passed eventually, and she spent most of that night staring dry-eyed into the dark, gripped by those dark and bitterly satisfying fantasies of revenge, which only a jilted and previously complacent lover can fully entertain. Mr. Gaunt's first, by appointment only, customer arrived promptly at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning. This was Lucille Dunham, one of the waitresses at Nan's Luncheonette. Lucille had been struck by a deep, hopeless aching at the sight of the black pearls in one of the display cases of Needful Things. She knew she could never hope to buy such an expensive item, never in a million years, not on the salary that skinflint Nan Roberts paid her. All the same, when Mr. Gaunt suggested that they talk about it without half the town leaning over their shoulders, so to speak, Lucille had leaped at the offer the way a hungry fish might leap at a sparkling lure. She left Needful Things at 8:20, an expression of dazed, dreaming happiness on her face. She had purchased the black pearls for the unbelievable price of $38.50. She had also promised to play a little prank, perfectly harmless, on that stuffed-shirt Baptist minister, William Rose. That wouldn't be work, as far as Lucille was concerned. It would be pure pleasure. The Bible-quoting stinker had never once left her a tip, not even so much as one thin dime. Lucille, a good Methodist who didn't in the slightest mind shaking her tail to a hot boogie beat on Saturday night, had heard of storing up your reward in heaven. She wondered if the Reverend Rose had heard that it was more blessed to give than to receive. Well, she would pay him back a little, and it was really quite harmless. Mr. Gaunt had told her so. That gentleman watched her go with a pleasant smile on his face. He had an extremely busy day planned, extremely busy, with appointments every half hour or so and lots of telephone calls to make. The carnival was well established. One major attraction had been tested successfully. The time to start up all the rides at once was now near at hand. As always, when he reached this point, whether in Lebanon, Ankara, the western provinces of Canada, or right here in Hicksville, USA, he felt there were just not enough hours in the day. Yet one bent every effort toward one's goal, for busy hands were happy hands, and to strive was in itself noble and if his old eyes did not deceive him, the day's second customer, Yvette Gendron, was hurrying up the sidewalk toward the canopy right now. "Busy, busy, busy day," Mr. Gaunt murmured, and fixed a large, welcoming smile on his face. Alan Pangborn arrived at his own office at 8:30, and there was already a message slip taped to the side of his phone. Henry Payton of the state police had called at 7:45. He wanted Alan to return the call ASAP. Alan settled into his chair, placed the telephone between his ear and his shoulder, and hit the button which auto-dialed the Oxford Barracks. From the top drawer of his desk, he took 4 silver dollars. "Hello, Alan," Henry said. "I'm afraid I've got some bad news about your double murder." "Oh, so all at once it's my double murder," Alan said. He closed his fist around the 4 cartwheels, squeezed, and opened his hand again. Now there were 3. He leaned back in his chair and cocked his feet up on his desk. "It really must be bad news." "You don't sound surprised." "Nope." He squeezed his fist shut again and used his pinky finger to force the lowest silver dollar in the stack. This was an operation of some delicacy, but Alan was more than equal to the challenge. The silver dollar slipped from his fist and tumbled down his sleeve. There was a quiet chink sound as it struck the first one, a sound that would be covered by the magician's patter in an actual performance. Alan opened his hand again, and now there were only 2 cartwheels. "Maybe you wouldn't mind telling me why not," Henry said. He sounded slightly testy. "Well, I've spent most of the last 2 days thinking about it," Alan said. Even this was an understatement. From the moment on Sunday afternoon when he had first seen that Nettie Cobb was one of the 2 women lying dead at the foot of the stop sign, he had thought of little else. He even dreamed about it, and the feeling that all the numbers added up short had become a nagging certainty. This made Henry's call not an annoyance, but a relief, and saved Alan the trouble of calling him. He squeezed the 2 silver dollars in his hand. Chink opened his hand. Now there was 1. "What bothers you?" Henry asked. "Everything," Alan said flatly, starting with the fact that it happened at all. I suppose the thing that itches the worst is the way the timetable of the crime works, or doesn't work. I keep trying to see Nettie Cobb finding her dog dead and then sitting down to write all those notes. And do you know what? I keep not being able to do it. And every time I can't do it, I wonder how much of this stupid goddamn business I'm not seeing. Alan squeezed his fist viciously shut, opened it, and then there were none. Uh-huh. So maybe my bad news is your good news. Someone else was involved, Alan. We don't know who killed the Cobb woman's dog, but we can be almost positive that it wasn't Wilma Jurczyk. Alan's feet came off the desk in a hurry. The cartwheel slid out of his sleeve and hit the top of his desk in a little silver runnel. One of them came down on edge and rolled for the side of the desk. Alan's hand flicked out, spooky quick, and snatched it back before it could get away. I think you better tell me what you got, Henry. Uh-huh. Let's start with the dog. The body was turned over to John Palin, a DVM in South Portland. He is to animals what Henry Ryan is to people. He says that because the corkscrew penetrated the dog's heart and it died almost instantly, he can give us a fairly restricted time of death. That's a nice change, Alan said. He was thinking of those Agatha Christie novels which Annie had read by the dozen. In those, it seemed there was always some doddering village doctor who was more than willing to set the time of death as between 4:30 p.m. and 5:15. After almost 20 years as a law enforcement officer, Alan knew a more realistic response to the time of death question was sometime last week, maybe. It is, isn't it? Anyway, this Dr. Palin says the dog died between 10 o'clock and noon. Peter Jurczyk says that when he came into the master bedroom to get ready for church, at a little past 10, his wife was in the shower. Yes, we knew it was tight, Alan said. He was a little disappointed, but this guy Palin must allow for a margin of error, unless he's God. 15 minutes is all it takes to make Wilma look good for it. Yeah? How good did she look to you, Alan? He considered the question, then said heavily, "To tell the truth, old buddy, she doesn't look that good. She never did." Alan forced himself to add, "Just the same, we'd look pretty silly keeping this case open on the basis of some dog doctor's report and a gap of, what, 15 minutes? Okay, let's talk about the note on the corkscrew. You remember the note? Nobody slings mud at my clean sheets. I told you I'd get you. The very one. The handwriting expert in Augusta is still mooning over it, but Peter Jurczyk provided us with a sample of his wife's handwriting, and I've got Xerox copies of both the note and the sample on the desk in front of me. They don't match. No way do they match. The hell you say? The hell I don't. I thought you were the guy who wasn't surprised. I knew something was wrong, but it's been those rocks with the notes on them that I haven't been able to get out of my mind. The time sequence is screwy, and that's made me uncomfortable, yeah, but on the whole, I guess I was willing to sit still for it, mostly because it seems like such a Wilma Jurczyk thing to do. You're sure she didn't disguise her handwriting? He didn't believe it. The idea of traveling incognito had never been Wilma Jurczyk's style, but it was a possibility that had to be covered. Me? I'm positive, but I'm not the expert, and what I think won't stand up in court. That's why the notes and graph analysis. When will the handwriting guy file his report? Who knows? Meantime, take my word for it, Alan. They're apples and oranges, nothing alike. Well, if Wilma didn't do it, someone sure wanted Nettie to believe she did. Who? And why? Why, for God's sake? I don't know, Scout. It's your town. In the meantime, I have two more things for you. Shoot. Alan put the silver dollars back into his drawer, then made a tall, skinny man in a top hat walk across the wall. On the return trip, the top hat became a cane. Whoever killed the dog left a set of bloody fingerprints on the inner knob of Nettie's front door. That's big number one. Hot damn! Warm damn at best, I'm afraid. They're blurry. The perp probably left them grasping the doorknob to go out. No good at all? We've got some fragments that might be useful, although there isn't much chance that they'd stand up in court. I've sent them to FBI Print Magic in Virginia. They're doing some pretty amazing reconstructive work on partials these days. They're slower than cold molasses. It'll probably be a week or even 10 days before I hear back. But in the meantime, I compared the partials with the Jurczyk woman's prints, which were delivered to me by the ever-thoughtful medical examiner's office last evening. No match? Well, it's like the handwriting, Alan. It's comparing partials to totals, and if I testified in court on something like that, the defense would chew me a new asshole. But since we're sitting at the bullshit table, so to speak, no, they're nothing alike. There's the question of size, for one thing. Wilma Jurczyk had small hands. The partials came from someone with big hands. Even when you allow for the blurring, they are damn big hands. A man's prints? I'm sure of it. But again, it'd never stand up in court. Who gives a fuck? On the wall, a shadow lighthouse suddenly appeared, then turned into a pyramid. The pyramid opened like a flower and became a goose flying through the sunshine. Alan tried to see the face of the man, not Wilma Jurczyk, but some man, who had gone into Nettie's house after Nettie had left on Sunday morning. The man who had killed Nettie's raider with a corkscrew and then framed Wilma for it. He looked for a face and saw nothing but smoke and shadows. Henry, who would even want to do something like this if it wasn't Wilma? I don't know, but I think we might have a witness to the rock-throwing incident. What? Who? I said might, remember. I know what you said. Don't tease me. Who is it? A kid. The woman who lives next door to the Jurczyks heard noises and came out to try and see what was going on. She said she thought maybe that bitch, her words, had finally gotten mad enough at her husband to throw him out a window. She saw the kid pedaling away from the house, looking scared. She asked him what was going on. He said he thought maybe Mr. and Mrs. Jurczyk were having a fight. Well, that was what she thought, too, and since the noises had stopped by then, she didn't think any more about it. That must have been Jillian Miss Liberski, Alan said. The house on the other side of the Jurczyk place is empty, up for sale. Yeah, Jillian Miss Liberski, that's what I got here. Who is the kid? Dunno. She recognized him, but couldn't come up with a name. She says he's from the neighborhood, though, probably from right there on the block. We'll find him. How old? She said between 11 and 14. Henry, be a pal and let me find him. Would you do that? Yep, Henry said at once, and Alan relaxed. I don't understand why we have to roll these investigations when the crime happens right in the county seat anyway. They let them fry their own fish in Portland and Bangor, so why not in Castle Rock? Christ, I wasn't even sure how to pronounce that woman's name until you said it out loud. There are a lot of poles in Castle Rock, Alan said absently. He tore a pink traffic warning form from the pad on his desk and jotted Jill Miss Liberski and Boy 11 to 14 on the back. If my guys find this kid, he's going to see three big state troops and be so scared everything goes out of his head, Henry said. He probably knows you. Don't you go around and talk at the schools? Yes, about the DARE program and on Law and Safety Day, Alan said. He was trying to think of families with kids on the block where the Jurczyks and the Miss Liberskis lived. If Jill Miss Liberski recognized him but didn't know his name, that probably meant the kid lived around the corner, or maybe on Pond Street. Alan wrote three names quickly on the sheet of scrap paper, Delois, Rusk, Bellingham. There were probably other families with boys in the right age group that he couldn't remember right off the bat, but those three would do for a start. A quick canvas would almost certainly turn the kid up. Did Jill know what time she heard the ruckus and saw the boy? Alan asked. She's not sure, but she thinks it was after 11. So it wasn't the Jurczyks fighting because the Jurczyks were at mass. Right. Then it was the rock thrower. Right again. This one's real weird, Henry. That's three in a row. One more and you win the toaster oven. I wonder if the kid saw who it was. Ordinarily, I'd say too good to be true, but the Miss Liberski woman said he looked scared, so maybe he did. If he did see the perp, I'll bet you a shot and a beer it wasn't Nettie Cobb. I think somebody played them off against each other, Scout, and maybe just for the kick of the thing. Just for that. But Alan, who knew the town better than Henry ever would, found this fantastical. Maybe the kid did it himself, he said. Maybe that's why he looked scared. Maybe what we've got here is a simple case of vandalism. In a world where there's a Michael Jackson and an asshole like Axl Rose, anything's possible, I suppose, Henry said. But I'd like the possibility of vandalism a lot better if the kid was 16 or 17, you know? Yes, Alan said. And why speculate at all, if you can find the kid? You can, can't you? I'm pretty sure, yeah. But I'd like to wait until school lets out, if that's okay with you. It's like you said, scaring him won't do any good. Fine by me. The two ladies aren't going anywhere but into the ground. The reporters are around here, but they're only a nuisance. I swat them like flies. Alan looked out the window in time to see a news van from WMTW-TV go cruising slowly past, probably bound for the main courthouse entrance around the corner. Yeah, they're here too, he said. Can you call me by 5? By 4, Alan said. Thanks, Henry. Don't mention it, Henry Payton said, and hung up. Alan's first impulse was to go get Norris Ridgwick and tell him all about this. Norris made a hell of a good sounding board, if nothing else. Then he remembered that Norris was probably parked in the middle of Castle Lake with his new fishing rod in his hand. He made a few more shadow animals on the wall, then got up. He felt restless, oddly uneasy. It wouldn't hurt to cruise around the block where the murders had taken place. He might remember a few more families with kids in the right age brackets if he actually looked at the houses. And who knew? Maybe what Henry had said about kids also held true for middle-aged Polish ladies who bought their clothes at Lane Bryant. Jill Miss Leberski's memory might improve if the questions were coming from someone with a familiar face. He started to grab his uniform hat off the top of the coat tree by the door and then left it where it was. It might be better today, he decided, if I only look semi-official. As far as that goes, it wouldn't kill me to take the station wagon. He left the office and stood in the bullpen for a moment, bemused. John LaPointe had turned his desk and the space around it into something that looked in need of Red Cross flood relief. Papers were stacked up everywhere. The drawers were nested inside each other, making a tower of Babel on John's desk blotter. It looked ready to fall over at any second. And John, ordinarily the most cheerful of police officers, was red-faced and cursing. "I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap, Johnny," Alan said, grinning. John jumped, then turned around. He answered Alan with a grin of his own, one which was both shame-faced and distracted. "Sorry, Alan, I..." Then Alan was moving. He crossed the room with the same liquid, silent speed that had so struck Polly Chalmers on Friday evening. John LaPointe's mouth fell open. Then, from the corner of his eye, he saw what Alan was up to. The two drawers on top of the stack he had made were starting to tumble. Alan was fast enough to avert an utter disaster, but not fast enough to catch the first drawer. It landed on his feet, scattering papers, paper clips, and loose bunches of staples everywhere. He pinned the other two against the side of John's desk with his palms. "Holy Jesus, that was lickety-split, Alan," John exclaimed. "Thank you, John," Alan said with a pained smile. The drawers were starting to slip. Pushing harder did no good. It only made the desk start to move. Also, his toes hurt. "Toss all the compliments you want, by all means. But in between, maybe you could take the goddamn drawer off my feet." "Oh, shit. Right, right." John hurried to do it. In his eagerness to remove the drawer, he bumped Alan. Alan lost his tenuous pressure hold on the two drawers he had caught in time. They also landed on his feet. "Ouch!" Alan yelled. He started to grab his right foot and then decided the left one hurt worse. "Bastard!" "Holy Jesus, Alan, I'm sorry." "What have you got in there?" Alan asked, hopping away with his left foot in his hand. "Half of Castle Land Quarry?" "I guess it has been a while since I cleaned him out." John smiled guiltily and began stuffing papers and office supplies helter-skelter back into the drawers. His conventionally handsome face was flaming scarlet. He was on his knees, and when he pivoted to get the paper clips and staples which had gone under Klutz's desk, he kicked over a tall stack of forms and reports that he had stacked on the floor. Now the bullpen area of the sheriff's office was beginning to resemble a tornado zone. "Whoops!" John said. "Whoops!" Alan said, sitting on Norris Ridgwick's desk and trying to massage his toes through his heavy black police-issue shoes. "Whoops is good, John. A very accurate description of the situation. This is a whoops if I ever saw one." "Sorry," John said again, and actually wormed under his desk on his stomach, sweeping errant clips and staples toward him with the sides of his hands. Alan was not sure if he should laugh or cry. John's feet were wagging back and forth as he moved his hands, spreading the papers on the floor widely and evenly. "John, get out of there!" Alan yelled. He was trying hard not to laugh, but he could tell already it was going to be a lost cause. LaPointe jerked. His head bonked briskly against the underside of his desk, and another stack of papers, one which had been deposited on the very edge of gravity to make room for the drawers, fell over the side. Most flumped straight to the floor, but dozens went seesawing lazily back and forth through the air. "He's going to be filing those all day," Alan thought resignedly, "maybe all week." Then he could hold on no longer. He threw back his head and bellowed laughter. Andy Clutterbuck, who had been in the dispatcher's office, came out to see what was going on. "Sheriff," he asked, "everything okay?" "Yeah," Alan said. Then he looked at the reports and forms scattered held to breakfast and began to laugh again. John's doing a little creative paperwork here, that's all. John crawled out from under his desk and stood up. He looked like a man who wishes mightily that someone would ask him to stand at attention or maybe hit the deck and do 40 push-ups. The front of his previously immaculate uniform was covered with dust, and in spite of his amusement, Alan made a mental note. It had been a long time since Eddie Warburton had taken care of the floor under these bullpen desks. Then he began laughing again. There was simply no help for it. Cluck looked from John to Alan, and then back to John again, puzzled. "Okay," Alan said, getting himself under control at last. "What were you looking for, John? The Holy Grail? The lost cord? What?" "My wallet," John said, brushing ineffectually at the front of his uniform. "I can't find my goddamn wallet." "But did you check your car?" "Both of them," John said. He passed a disgusted glance over the asteroid belt of junk around his desk. "The cruiser I was driving last night and my Pontiac. But sometimes when I'm here, I stick it in a desk drawer because it makes a lump against my ass when I sit down. So I was checking." "It wouldn't bust your ass like that if you didn't keep your whole goddamn life in there, John," Andy Clutterbuck said reasonably. "Clut," Alan said. "Go play in the traffic, would you?" "Huh?" Alan rolled his eyes. "Go find something to do. I think John and I can handle this. We're trained investigators. If it turns out we can't, we'll let you know." "Oh, sure. Just trying to help, you know. I've seen his wallet. It looks like he's got the whole Library of Congress in there. In fact..." "Thanks for your input, Clut. We'll see you." "Okay," Clut said. "Always glad to help. Later, dudes." Alan rolled his eyes. He felt like laughing again, but controlled himself. It was clear from John's unhappy expression that it was no joke to him. He was embarrassed, but that was only part of it. Alan had lost a wallet or two in his time, and he knew what a shitty feeling it was. Losing the money in it and the hassle of reporting credit cards gone west was only part of it, and not necessarily the worst part, either. You kept remembering stuff you had tucked away in there, stuff that might seem like junk to someone else, but was irreplaceable to you. John was hunkered down on his hams, picking up papers, sorting them, stacking them, and looking disconsolate. Alan helped. "Did you really hurt your toes, Alan?" "Nah, you know these shoes. It's like wearing Brinks trucks on your feet. How much was in the wallet, John?" No more than $20, I guess. But I got my hunting license last week, and that was in there. Also my MasterCard. I'll have to call the bank and tell them to cancel the number if I can't find the damned wallet. But what I really want are the pictures. Mom and Dad, my sisters, you know, stuff like that." But it wasn't the picture of his mother and father, or the ones of his sisters, that John really cared about. The really important one was the picture of him and Sally Ratcliffe. Clut had taken it at the Freiburg State Fair about 3 months before Sally had broken up with John in favor of that stone brain, Lester Pratt. "Well," Alan said, "it'll turn up. The money and the plastic may be gone, but the wallet and the pictures will probably come home, John. They usually do. You know that." "Yeah," John said with a sigh. "It's just that, damn, I keep trying to remember if I had it this morning when I came to work. I just can't." "Well, I hope you find it. Stick a lost notice up on the bulletin board, why don't you?" "I will. And I'll get the rest of this mess cleaned up." "I know you will, John. Take it easy." Alan went out to the parking lot, shaking his head. The silver bell tinkled. Sonny Jacket came into Needful Things slowly, warily, kneading his grease-stained Sunoco cap in his hands. His manner was that of a man who sincerely believes he will soon break many expensive things, no matter how much he doesn't want to. Breaking things, his face proclaimed, was not his desire, but his karma. "Mr. Jacket!" Leland Gaunt cried his customary welcome with his customary vigor, and then made another tiny check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. "So glad you could stop by." Sonny advanced 3 steps further into the room and then stopped, glancing warily from the glass cases to Mr. Gaunt. "Well," he said, "I didn't come in to buy nothing. Got to put you straight on that. Old Harry Samuels said you asked if I'd stop by this morning if I had a chance. Said you had a socket wrench set that was some nice. I've been looking for one, but this ain't no store for the likes of me. I'm just making my manners to you, sir." "Well, I appreciate your honesty," Mr. Gaunt said, "but you don't want to speak too soon, Mr. Jacket. This is one nice set of sockets, double measure adjustable." "Oh, eh, ah?" Sonny raised his eyebrows. He knew there were such things which made it possible to work on both foreign and domestic cars with the same socket wrenches, but he had never actually seen such a rig. That so? Yes, I put them in the back room, Mr. Jacket, as soon as I heard you were looking. Otherwise, they would have gone almost at once, and I wanted you to at least see them before I sold the set to someone else. Sonny Jacket reacted to this with instant Yankee suspicion. Now, why would you want to do that? Because I have a classic car, and classic cars need frequent repairs. I've been told you're the best mechanic this side of Derry. Oh, Sonny relaxed. Mayhap I am. What have you got for wheels? A Tucker. Sonny's eyebrows shot up, and he looked at Mr. Gaunt with a new respect. A torpedo. Fancy that. No, I have a talisman. Eh? Never heard of a Tucker talisman. There were only two built, the prototype and mine. In 1953, that was. Mr. Tucker moved to Brazil not long after, where he died. Mr. Gaunt smiled mistily. Preston was a sweet fellow, and a wizard when it came to auto design, but he was no businessman. That so? Yes. The mist in Mr. Gaunt's eyes cleared. But that's yesterday, and this is today. Turn the page, eh, Mr. Jacket? Turn the page, I always say. Face front, march cheerily into the future, and never look back. Sonny regarded Mr. Gaunt from the corners of his eyes with some unease and said nothing. Let me show you the socket wrenches. Sonny didn't agree at once. Instead, he looked doubtfully at the contents of the glass cases again. Can't afford nothing too nice. Got bills a mile high. Sometimes I think I ought to get right the hell out of business and go on the county. I know what you mean, Mr. Gaunt said. It's the damned Republicans. That's what I think. Sonny's knotted, distrustful face relaxed all at once. You're goddamned right about that, chummy, he exclaimed. George Bush has damn near ruined this country, him and his goddamn war. But do you think the Democrats have anyone to put up against him next year who can win? Doubtful, Mr. Gaunt said. Jesse Jackson, for instance, a nigger. He looked truculently at Mr. Gaunt, who inclined his head slightly as if to say, Yes, my friend, speak your mind. We are both men of the world who are not afraid to call a spade a spade. Sonny Jacket relaxed a little more, less self-conscious about the grease on his hands now, more at home. I got nothing against niggers, you understand, but the idea of a jig in the White House, gives me the shivers. Of course it does, Mr. Gaunt agreed. And that wop from New York. Mario Cuomo. Do you think a guy with a name like that can beat that four-eyed dink in the White House? No, Mr. Gaunt said. He held up his right hand, the long first finger placed about a quarter of an inch from his spatulate, ugly thumb. Besides, I mistrust men with tiny heads. Sonny gaped for a moment, then slapped his knee and gasped wheezy laughter. Mistrust men with tiny heads! Say, that's pretty good, mister. That's pretty goddamn good. Mr. Gaunt was grinning. They grinned at each other. Mr. Gaunt got the set of socket wrenches, which came in a leather case lined with black velvet, the most beautiful set of chrome steel alloy socket wrenches Sonny Jacket had ever seen. They grinned over the socket wrenches, baring their teeth like monkeys that will soon fight. And, of course, Sonny bought the set. The price was amazingly low. $170, plus a couple of really amusing tricks to be played on Don Hemphill and the Reverend Rose. Sonny told Mr. Gaunt it would be a pleasure. He would enjoy stinking up those psalm-singing Republican sons of whores' lives. They grinned over the trick to be played on Steamboat Willie and Don Hemphill. Sonny Jacket and Leland Gaunt, just a couple of grinning men of the world. And over the door, the little silver bell jingled. Henry Beaufort, owner and operator of the Mellow Tiger, lived in a house about a quarter of a mile from his place of business. Myra Evans parked in the Tiger's parking lot, empty now in the hot, unseasonable morning sunshine, and walked to the house. Considering the nature of her errand, this seemed a reasonable precaution. She needn't have worried. The Tiger didn't close until 1 in the a.m., and Henry rarely rose much before that same hour in the p.m. All the shades, both upstairs and down, were drawn. His car, a perfectly maintained 1960 Thunderbird that was his pride and joy, stood in the driveway. Myra was wearing a pair of jeans and one of her husband's blue work shirts. The tail of the shirt was out and hung almost to her knees. It concealed the belt she wore beneath and the scabbard hanging from the belt. Chuck Evans was a collector of World War II memorabilia, and although she did not know it, he had already made a purchase of his own in this area at the town's new shop. And there was a Japanese bayonet in the scabbard. Myra had taken it half an hour ago from the wall of Chuck's basement den. It bumped solidly against her right thigh at every step. She was very anxious to get this job done so she could get back to the picture of Elvis. Holding the picture, she had discovered, produced a kind of story. It wasn't a real story, but in most ways, always actually, she considered it better than a real story. Act One was the concert where the king pulled her up on stage to dance with him. Act Two was the green room after the show, and Act Three was in the limo. One of Elvis's Memphis guys was driving the limo, and the king didn't even bother to put up the black glass between the driver and them before doing the most outrageous and delicious things to her in the back seat as they drove to the airport. Act Four was titled On the Plane. In this act, they were in the Lisa Marie, Elvis's Convair jet, in the big double bed behind the partition at the back of the cabin, to be exact. That was the act Myra had been enjoying yesterday and this morning, cruising at 32,000 feet in the Lisa Marie, cruising in bed with the king. She wouldn't have minded staying there with him forever, but she knew she wouldn't. They were bound for Act Five, Graceland. Once they were there, things could only get better. But she had this little piece of business to take care of first. She had been lying in bed this morning after her husband left, naked except for her garter belt. The king had been very clear in his desire for Myra to leave that on. The picture clasped tightly in her hands, moaning and writhing slowly on the sheets. And then, suddenly, the double bed was gone. The whispered drone of the Lisa Marie's engines was gone. The smell of the king's English leather was gone. In the place of these wonderful things was Mr. Gaunt's face, only he no longer looked as he did in his shop. The skin on his face looked blistered, seared with some fabulous secret heat. It pulsed and writhed, as if there were things beneath, struggling to get out. And when he smiled, his big square teeth had become a double row of fangs. "It's time, Myra," Mr. Gaunt had said. "I want to be with Elvis," she whined. "I'll do it, but not right now. Please, not right now." "Yes, right now. You promised, and you're going to make good on your promise. You'll be very sorry if you don't, Myra." She had heard a brittle cracking. She looked down and saw with horror that a jagged crack now split the glass over the king's face. "No," she cried. "No, don't do that." "I'm not doing it," Mr. Gaunt had responded with a laugh. "You're doing it. You're doing it by being a silly, lazy little cunt. This is America, Myra, where only whores do business in bed. In America, respectable people have to get out of bed and earn the things they need or lose them forever." "I think you forgot that. Of course, I can always find somebody else to play that little trick on Mr. Beaufort, but as for your beautiful affaire du coeur with the king..." Another crack raced like a silver lightning bolt across the glass covering the picture, and the face beneath it, she observed with mounting horror, was growing old and wrinkled and rattled as the corrupting air seeped in and went to work on it.
"No! I'll do it! I'll do it right now! I'm getting up right now, see? Only make it stop! Make it stop!"
Myra had leaped to the floor with the speed of a woman who has discovered she is sharing her bed with a nest of scorpions. "When you keep your promise, Myra," Mr. Gaunt said. Now he was speaking from some deep, sunken hollow in her mind. "You know what to do, don't you?"
"Yes, I know."
Myra looked despairingly at the picture, the image of an old, ill man, his face puffy from years of excess and indulgence. The hand which held the microphone was a vulture's talon. "When you come back with your mission accomplished," Mr. Gaunt said, "the picture will be fine. Only don't let anyone see you, Myra. If anyone sees you, you'll never see him again."
"I won't," she babbled. "I swear I won't."
And now, as she reached Henry Beaufort's house, she remembered that admonition. She looked around to make sure no one was coming along the road. It was deserted in both directions. A crow cawed somnolently in someone's October barren field. There was no other sound. The day seemed to throb like a living thing, and the land lay stunned within the slow beat of its unseasonable heart. Myra walked up the driveway, pulling up the tail of the blue shirt, feeling to make sure of the scabbard and the bayonet inside it. Sweat ran, trickling and itching, down the center of her back and under her bra. Although she didn't know it, and wouldn't have believed it if told, she had achieved a momentary beauty in the rural stillness. Her vague, unthoughtful face had filled, at least during these moments, with a deep purpose and determination which had never been there before. Her cheekbones were clearly defined for the first time since high school, when she had decided her mission in life was to eat every yodel and ding-dong and hoodsie rocket in the world. During the last 4 days or so, she had been much too busy having progressively weirder and weirder sex with the king to think much about eating. Her hair, which usually hung around her face in a lank, floppy rug, was tied back in a tight little horsetail, exposing her brow. Perhaps shocked by the sudden overdose of hormones and the equally sudden cutback in sugar consumption after years of daily overdoses, most of the pimples that had flared on her face like uneasy volcanoes ever since she was 12 had gone into remission. Even more remarkable were her eyes, wide, blue, almost feral. They were not the eyes of Myra Evans, but of some jungle beast that might turn vicious at any moment. She reached Henry's car. Now something was coming along 117, an old rattling farm truck headed for town. Myra slipped around to the front of the T-Bird and crouched behind its grill until the truck was gone. Then she stood up again. From the breast pocket of her shirt, she took a folded sheet of paper. She opened it, smoothed it carefully, and then stuck it under one of the bird's windshield wipers so the brief message written there showed clearly. "Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog!" it read. It was time for the bayonet. She took another quick glance around, but the only thing moving in the whole hot daylight world was a single crow, perhaps the one which had called before. It flapped down to the top of a telephone pole directly across from the driveway and seemed to watch her. Myra took the bayonet out, gripped it tightly in both hands, stooped, and rammed it up to the hilt in the white wall on the driver's side front. Her face was pulled back in a wincing snarl, anticipating a loud bang, but there was only a sudden breathless whoosh, the sound a big man might make after a sucker punch to the gut. The T-Bird settled appreciably to the left. Myra yanked the bayonet, tearing the hole wider. Grateful Chuck liked to keep his toys sharp. When she had cut a ragged rubber smile in the rapidly deflating tire, she went around to the one on the passenger side front and did it again. She was still anxious to get back to her picture, but she found she was glad she had come just the same. This was sort of exciting. The thought of Henry's face when he saw what had happened to his precious Thunderbird was actually making her horny. God knew why, but she thought that when she finally got back on board the Lisa Marie, she might have a new trick or two to show the king. She moved on to the rear tires. The bayonet did not cut quite so easily now, but she made up for it with her own enthusiasm, sawing energetically through the sidewalls of the tires. When the job was done, when all four tires were not just punctured but gutted, Myra stepped back to survey her work. She was breathing rapidly, and she armed sweat off her forehead in a quick, mannish gesture. Henry Beaufort's Thunderbird now sat a good 6 inches lower on the driveway than it had been when she arrived. It rested on its wheel rims with the expensive radial spread out around them in wrinkled rubber puddles. And then, although she had not been asked to do so, Myra decided to add the extra touch that means so much. She raked the tip of the bayonet down the side of the car, splitting the deeply polished surface with a long, jagged scratch. The bayonet made a small wailing screech against the metal, and Myra looked at the house, suddenly sure that Henry Beaufort must have heard, that the shade in the bedroom window was suddenly going to flap up, and he would be looking out at her. It didn't happen, but she knew it was time to leave. She had overstayed her welcome here, and besides, back in her own bedroom, the king awaited. Myra hurried down the driveway, reseating the bayonet in its scabbard, and then dropping the tail of Chuck's shirt over it again. One car passed her before she got back to the Mellow Tiger, but it was going the other way. Assuming the driver wasn't ogling her in his rearview mirror, he would have seen only her back. She slid into her own car, yanked the rubber band out of her hair, allowing her locks to fall around her face in their usual limp fashion, and drove back to town. She did this one-handed. Her other hand had business to take care of below her waist. She let herself into her house and bounded up the stairs by twos. The picture was on the bed where she had left it. Myra kicked off her shoes, pushed her jeans down, grabbed the picture, and jumped into bed with it. The cracks in the glass were gone. The king had been restored to youth and beauty. The same could be said for Myra Evans, at least temporarily. Over the door, the silver bell sang its jingly little tune. "Hello, Mrs. Potter," Leland Gaunt said cheerily. He made a tick mark on the sheet by the cash register. "I'd about decided you weren't going to come by." "I almost didn't," Lenore Potter said. She looked upset, distracted. Her silver hair, usually coiffed to perfection, had been tacked up in an indifferent bun. An inch of her slip was showing beneath the hem of her expensive gray twill skirt, and there were dark circles beneath her eyes. The eyes themselves were restless, shooting from place to place with baleful, angry suspicion. "It was the howdy-doody puppet you wanted to look at, wasn't it? I believe you told me you have quite a collection of children's memorabilia." "I really don't believe I can look at such gentle things today, you know," Lenore said. She was the wife of the richest lawyer in Castle Rock, and she spoke in clipped, lawyerly tones. "I'm in an extremely poor frame of mind. I'm having a magenta day. Not just red, but magenta." Mr. Gaunt stepped around the main display case and came toward her, his face instantly filled with concern and sympathy. "My dear lady, what's happened? You look dreadful." "Of course I look dreadful," she snapped. "The normal flow of my psychic aura has been disrupted, badly disrupted. Instead of blue, the color of calm and serenity, my entire kalava has gone bright magenta. And it's all the fault of that bitch across the street, that high box bitch." Mr. Gaunt made peculiar soothing gestures which never quite touched any part of Lenore Potter's body. "What bitch is that, Mrs. Potter?" he asked, knowing perfectly well.
"Bonsaint, of course. Bonsaint. That nasty, lying Stephanie Bonsaint. My aura has never been magenta before, Mr. Gaunt. Deep pink a few times, yes. And once, after I was almost run down in the street by a drunk in Oxford, I think it might have turned red for a few minutes, but it has never been magenta. I simply cannot live like this."
"Of course not," Mr. Gaunt soothed. "No one could expect you to, my dear." His eyes finally captured hers. This was not easy with Mrs. Potter's gaze darting around in such a distracted manner, but he did finally manage. And when he did, Lenore calmed almost at once. Looking into Mr. Gaunt's eyes, she discovered, was almost like looking into her own aura when she had been doing all her exercises, eating the right foods, bean sprouts mostly, and maintaining the surfaces of her kalava with at least an hour of meditation when she arose in the morning and again before she went to bed at night. His eyes were the faded, serene blue of desert skies. "Come," he said, "over here." He led her to the short row of three high-backed plush velvet chairs where so many citizens of Castle Rock had sat over the last week. And when she was seated, Mr. Gaunt invited, "Tell me all about it."
"She's always hated me," Lenore said. "She's always thought that her husband hasn't risen in the firm as fast as she's wanted because my husband kept him back, and that I put him up to it. She is a woman with a small mind and a big bosom and a dirty gray aura. You know the type."
"Indeed," Mr. Gaunt said.
"But I never knew how much she hated me until this morning."
Lenore Potter was growing agitated again in spite of Mr. Gaunt's settling influence. "I got up, and my flower beds were absolutely ruined.
Ruined! Everything that was lovely yesterday is dying today. Everything which was soothing to the aura and nourishing to the kalava has been murdered. By that bitch! By that fucking Bonsaint bitch!"
Lenore's hands closed into fists, hiding the elegantly manicured nails. The fists drummed on the carved arms of the chair.
"Chrysanthemums, asters, marigolds. That bitch came over in the night and tore them all out of the ground, threw them everywhere. Do you know where my ornamental cabbages are this morning, Mr. Gaunt?"
"No. Where?" he asked her tenderly, still making those stroking motions just above her body. He actually had a good idea of where they were, and he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt who was responsible for the Calava-destroying mess. Melissa Clutterbuck. Lenore Potter did not suspect Deputy Clutterbuck's wife because she didn't know Deputy Clutterbuck's wife. Nor did Melissa Clutterbuck know Lenore, except to say hello to on the street. There had been no malice on Melissa's part, except, of course, Mr. Gaunt thought, for the normal malicious pleasure anyone feels when tearing the hell out of someone else's much-beloved possessions. She had torn up Lenore Potter's flower beds in partial payment for a set of Limoges china. When you got right down to the bottom of the thing, it was strictly business. Enjoyable, yes, Mr. Gaunt thought, but whoever said that business always had to be a drag?
My flowers are in the street, Lenore shouted, in the middle of Castle View. She didn't miss a trick. Even the African daisies are gone. All gone. All gone.
Did you see her?
I didn't need to see her. She's the only one who hates me enough to do something like that. And the flower beds are full of the marks of her high heels. I swear that little trollop wears her heels even to bed. Oh, Mr. Gaunt, she wailed. Every time I close my eyes, everything goes all purple. What am I going to do?
Mr. Gaunt said nothing for a moment. He only looked at her, fixing her with his eyes until she grew calm and distant. Is that better? He asked finally.
Yes, she replied in a faint, relieved voice. I believe I can see the blue again.
But you're too upset to even think about shopping.
Yes.
Considering what that bitch did to you.
Yes.
She ought to pay.
Yes.
If she ever tries anything like that again, she will pay.
Yes.
I may have just the thing. Sit right there, Mrs. Potter. I'll be back in a jiffy. In the meantime, think blue thoughts.
Blue,
she agreed dreamily. When Mr. Gaunt returned, he put one of the automatic pistols Ace had brought back from Cambridge in Lenore Potter's hands. It was fully loaded and gleamed a greasy blue-black under the display lights. Lenore raised the gun to eye level. She looked at it with deep pleasure and even deeper relief. Now, I would never urge anyone to shoot anyone else, Mr. Gaunt said. Not without a very good reason, at least. But you sound like a woman who might have a very good reason, Mrs. Potter.
Not the flowers. We both know they are not the important thing. Flowers are replaceable.
But your karma, your kalava, well, what else do we, any of us, really have? And he laughed deprecatingly.
Nothing,
she agreed. And pointed the automatic at the wall.
Pow! Pow, pow, pow! That's for you, you envying little round-heels trollop. I hope your husband ends up town garbage collector. It's what he deserves. It's what you both deserve.
You see that little lever there, Mrs. Potter? He pointed it out to her.
Yes, I see it.
That's the safety catch. If the bitch should come over again, trying to do more damage, you'd want to push that first. Do you understand?
Oh, yes, Lenore said in her sleeper's voice. I understand perfectly. Kapow!
No one would blame you. After all, a woman has to protect her property. A woman has to protect her karma. The Bon Saint creature probably won't come again. But if she does, he looked at her meaningfully.
If she does, it will be for the last time.
Lenore raised the short barrel of the automatic to her lips and kissed it softly. Now put that in your purse, Mr. Gaunt said, and get on home. Why, for all you know, she could be in your yard right now. In fact, she could be in your house. Lenore looked alarmed at this. Thin threads of sinister purple began to twist and twine through her blue aura. She got up, stuffing the automatic into her purse. Mr. Gaunt looked away from her, and she blinked her eyes rapidly several times as soon as he did.
I'm sorry, but I'll have to look at the howdy-doody marionette another time, Mr. Gaunt. I think I'd better go home. For all I know, that Bon Saint woman could be in my yard right now, while I'm here. She might even be in my house.
What a terrible idea, Mr. Gaunt said.
Yes, but property is a responsibility. It must be protected. We have to face these things, Mr. Gaunt. How much do I owe you for the...
But she could not remember exactly what it was he had sold her, although she was sure she would very soon now. She gestured vaguely at her purse instead. No charge to you. Those are on special today. Think of it as, his smile widened, as a free get-acquainted gift.
Thank you, Lenore said. I feel ever so much better.
As always, said Mr. Gaunt with a little bow, I am glad to have been of service. Norris Ridgwick was not fishing. Norris Ridgwick was looking in Hugh Priest's bedroom window. Hugh lay on his bed in a loose heap, snoring at the ceiling. He wore only a pair of pea-stained boxer shorts. Clutched in his big, knuckly hands was a matted piece of fur. Norris couldn't be sure. Hugh's hands were very big and the window was very dirty, but he thought it was an old, moth-eaten foxtail. It didn't matter what it was, anyway. What mattered was that Hugh was asleep. Norris walked back down the lawn to where his personal car stood parked behind Hugh's Buick in the driveway. He opened the passenger door and leaned in. His fishing creel was sitting on the floor. The basin rod was in the back seat. He found he felt better, safer, if he kept it with him. It was still unused. The truth was just this simple. He was afraid to use it. He had taken it out on Castle Lake yesterday, all fitted up and ready to go, and then had hesitated just before making his first cast, with the rod cocked back over his shoulder. What if, he thought, a really big fish takes the lure? Smokey, for instance. Smokey was an old brown trout, the stuff of legend among the fisher people of Castle Rock. He was reputed to be over 2 feet long, wily as a weasel, strong as a stoat, tough as nails. According to the old-timers, Smokey's jaw bristled with the steel of anglers who had hooked him, but had been unable to hold him. What if he snaps the rod? It seemed crazy to believe that a lake trout, even a big one like Smokey, if Smokey actually existed, could snap a basin rod, but Norris supposed it was possible. And the way his luck had been running just lately, it might really happen. He could hear the brittle snap in his head, could feel the agony of seeing the rod in two pieces, one of them in the bottom of the boat and the other floating alongside. And once a rod was broken, it was Katie bar the door. There wasn't a thing you could do with it except throw it away. So he had ended up using the old Zebco after all. There had been no fish for dinner last night, but he had dreamed of Mr. Gaunt. In the dream, Mr. Gaunt had been wearing hip waders and an old fedora with feathered lures dancing jauntily around the brim. He was sitting in a rowboat about 30 feet out on Castle Lake, while Norris stood on the west shore with his dad's old cabin, which had burned down 10 years before, behind him. He stood and listened while Mr. Gaunt talked. Mr. Gaunt had reminded Norris of his promise, and Norris had awakened with a sense of utter certainty. He had done the right thing yesterday, putting the basin aside in favor of the old Zebco. The basin rod was too nice, far too nice. It would be criminal to risk it by actually using it. Now Norris opened his creel. He took out a long fish-gutting knife and walked over to Hugh's Buick. Nobody deserves it more than this drunken slob, he told himself, but something inside didn't agree. Something inside told him he was making a black and woeful mistake from which he might never recover. He was a policeman. Part of his job was to arrest people who did the sort of thing he was about to do. It was vandalism. That was exactly what it came down to, and vandals were bad guys. You decide, Norris. The voice of Mr. Gaunt spoke up suddenly in his mind. It's your fishing rod, and it's your God-given right of free will, too. You have a choice. You always have a choice, but... The voice in Norris Ridgwick's head didn't finish. It didn't need to. Norris knew what the consequences of turning away now would be. When he went back to his car, he would find the basin broken in two. Because every choice had consequences. Because in America, you could have anything you wanted, just as long as you could pay for it. If you couldn't pay, or refused to pay, you would remain needful forever. Besides, he'd do it to me, Norris thought petulantly, and not for a nice fishing rod like my basin, either. Hugh Priest would cut his own mother's throat for a bottle of Old Duke and a pack of Luckies. Thus he refuted guilt. When the something inside tried to protest again, tried to tell him to please think before he did this, think, he smothered it. Then he bent down and began to carve up the tires of Hugh's Buick. His enthusiasm, like Myra Evans's, grew as he worked. As an extra added attraction, he smashed the Buick's headlights and taillights, too. He finished by putting a note under the windshield wiper on the driver's side. It read, "Just a warning. You know what I'll come after next time, Hubert. You have kicked my rockola for the last time. Stay out of my bar." With the job done, he crept back up to the bedroom window, his heart hammering heavily in his narrow chest. Hugh Priest was still deeply asleep, clutching that ratty runner of fur. "Who in God's name would want a dirty old thing like that?" Norris wondered. "He's holding onto it like it was his fucking teddy bear." He went back to his car. He got in, shifted into neutral, and let his old Beetle roll soundlessly down the driveway. He didn't start the engine until the car was on the road. Then he drove away as fast as he could. He had a headache. His stomach was rolling around nastily in his guts, and he kept telling himself it didn't matter. He felt good. He felt good, goddammit. He felt really good. It didn't work very well until he reached back between the seats and grasped the limber, narrow fishing rod in his left fist. Then he began to feel calm again. Norris held it like that all the way home. The silver bell jingled. Slopey Dodd walked into Needful Things. "Hello, Slopey," Mr. Gaunt said.
Hello, Mr.
"You don't need to stutter around me, Slopey," Mr. Gaunt said. He raised one of his hands with the first two fingers extended in a fork. He drew them down through the air in front of Slopey's homely face, and Slopey felt something, a tangled, knotted snarl in his mind, magically dissolve. His mouth fell open. "What did you do to me?" he gasped. The words ran perfectly out of his mouth like beads on a string. "A trick Miss Ratcliffe would undoubtedly love to learn," Mr. Gaunt said. He smiled and made a mark beside Slopey's name on his sheet. He glanced at the grandfather clock ticking contentedly away in the corner. It was 1:15. "Tell me how you got out of school early. Will anyone be suspicious?"
"No."
Slopey's face was still amazed, and he appeared to be trying to look down at his own mouth, as if he could actually see the words tumbling from it in such unprecedented good order. "I told Mrs. DeWeese I felt sick to my stomach. She sent me to the school nurse. I told the nurse I felt better, but still sick. She asked me if I thought I could walk home. I said yes, so she let me go." Slopey paused. "I came because I fell asleep in study hall. I dreamed you were calling me."
"I was."
Mr. Gaunt tended his oddly even fingers beneath his chin and smiled at the boy. "Tell me, did your mother like the pewter teapot you got her?" A blush mounted into Slopey's cheeks, turning them the color of old brick. He started to say something, then gave up and inspected his feet instead. In his softest, kindest voice, Mr. Gaunt said, "You kept it yourself, didn't you?" Slopey nodded, still looking at his feet. He felt ashamed and confused. Worst of all, he felt a terrible sense of loss and grief. Somehow Mr. Gaunt had dissolved that tiresome, infuriating knot in his head. And what good did it do? He was too embarrassed to talk. "Now what, pray tell, does a 12-year-old boy want with a pewter teapot?" Slopey's cowlick, which had bobbed up and down a few seconds ago, now waved from side to side as he shook his head. He didn't know what a 12-year-old boy wanted with a pewter teapot. He only knew that he wanted to keep it. He liked it. He really, really liked it. "Feels," he muttered at last. "Pardon me?" Mr. Gaunt asked, raising his single, wavy eyebrow. "I like the way it feels," I said. "Slopey, Slopey," Mr. Gaunt said, coming around the counter. "You don't have to explain to me. I know all about that peculiar thing people call pride of possession. I have made it the cornerstone of my career." Slopey Dodd shrank away from Mr. Gaunt in alarm. "Don't you touch me. Please don't." "Slopey, I have no more intention of touching you than I do of telling you to give your mother the teapot. It's yours. You can do anything you want with it. In fact, I applaud your decision to keep it."
You
do?" "I do. Indeed I do. Selfish people are happy people. I believe that with all my heart. But Slopey..." Slopey raised his head a little and looked fearfully through the hanging fringe of his red hair at Leland Gaunt. "The time has come for you to finish paying for it." "Oh!" An expression of vast relief filled Slopey's face. Is that all you wanted me for? I thought maybe. But he either couldn't or didn't dare finish. He hadn't been sure what Mr. Gaunt had wanted. Yes. Do you remember who you were supposed to play a trick on? Sure, Coach Pratt. Right. There are two parts to this prank. You have to put something somewhere, plus you have to tell Coach Pratt something. And if you follow directions exactly, the teapot will be yours forever. Can I talk like this, too? Slopey asked eagerly. Can I talk without stuttering forever, too? Mr. Gaunt sighed regretfully. I'm afraid you'll have to go back to the way you were as soon as you leave my shop, Slopey. I believe I do have an anti-stuttering device somewhere in stock, but please, please, Mr. Gaunt, I'll do anything. I'll do anything to anyone. I hate to stutter. I know you would. But that's just the problem, don't you see? I am rapidly running out of pranks which need to be played. My dance card, you might say, is nearly full. So you couldn't pay me. Slopey hesitated a long time before speaking again. When he did, his voice was low and diffident. Couldn't you... I mean, do you ever just give things away, Mr. Gaunt? Leland Gaunt's face grew deeply sorrowful. Oh, Slopey, how often I thought of it, and with such longing. There is a deep, untapped well of charity in my heart. But? It just wouldn't be business, Mr. Gaunt finished. He favored Slopey with a compassionate smile, but his eyes sparkled so wolfishly that Slopey took a step backward. You understand, don't you?
Yeah, sure.
Besides, Mr. Gaunt went on, the next few hours are crucial to me. Once things really get rolling, they can rarely be stopped. But for the time being, I must make prudence my watchword. If you suddenly stopped stuttering, it might raise questions. That would be bad. The sheriff is already asking questions he has no business asking. His face darkened momentarily, and then his ugly, charming, jostling smile burst forth again. But I intend to take care of him, Slopey. Ah, yes. Sheriff Pangborn, you mean? Yes. Sheriff Pangborn, I mean. Mr. Gaunt raised his first two fingers and once again drew them down in front of Slopey Dodd's face from forehead to chin. But we never talked about him, did we?
Talked about who?
Slopey asked, bewildered.
Exactly.
Leland Gaunt was wearing a jacket of dark gray suede today, and from one of its pockets he produced a black leather wallet. He held it out to Slopey, who took it gingerly, being careful not to touch Mr. Gaunt's fingers. You know Coach Pratt's car, don't you?
The Mustang?
Sure. Put this in it, under the passenger seat, with just a corner sticking out. Go to the high school right now. It wants to be there before the last bell. Do you understand?
Yes.
Then you're to wait until he comes out. And when he does... Mr. Gaunt went on speaking in a low murmur, and Slopey looked up at him, jaw slack, eyes dazed, nodding every once in a while. Slopey Dodd left a few minutes later with John LaPointe's wallet tucked into his shirt. Nettie lay in a plain gray casket which Polly Chalmers had paid for. Alan had asked her to let him help share the expense, and she'd refused in that simple but final way he had come to know, respect, and accept. The coffin stood on steel runners above a plot in Homeland Cemetery, near the area where Polly's people were buried. The mound of earth next to it was covered with a carpet of bright green artificial grass which sparkled feverishly in the hot sunlight. That fake grass never failed to make Alan shudder. There was something obscene about it, something hideous. He liked it even less than the mortician's practice of first rouging the dead and then dolling them up in their finest clothes so they looked as if they were bound for a disco weekend in Boston instead of a long season of decay amid the roots and the worms. Reverend Tom Killingworth, the Methodist minister who conducted twice weekly services at Juniper Hill and who had known Nettie well, performed the service at Polly's request. The homily had been brief but warm, full of reference to the Nettie Cobb this man had known, a woman who had been slowly and bravely coming out of the shadows of insanity, a woman who had taken the courageous decision to try to treat once more with the world which had hurt her so badly. When I was growing up, Tom Killingworth said, my mother kept a plaque with a lovely Irish saying on it in her sewing room. It said, may ye be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. Nettie Cobb had a hard life, and in many ways a sad life. But in spite of that, I do not believe she and the devil ever had much to do with each other. In spite of her terrible, untimely death, my heart believes that it is to heaven she has gone, and that the devil still hasn't gotten the news. Killingworth raised his arms in the traditional gesture of benediction. Let us pray. From the far side of the hill, where Wilma Jerzyk was being buried at the same time, came the sound of many voices rising and falling in response to Father John Brigham. Over there, cars were lined up from the burial site all the way to the cemetery's east gate. They had come for Peter Jerzyk, the living, if not for his dead wife. Over here, there were only five mourners: Polly, Alan, Rosalie Drake, old Lenny Partridge, who went to all funerals on general principles so long as it wasn't one of the Pope's army getting buried, and Norris Ridgwick. Norris looked pale and distracted. Fish must not have been biting, Alan thought. May the Lord bless you and keep your memories of Nettie Cobb fresh and green in your hearts, Killingworth said, and beside Alan, Polly began to cry again. He put an arm around her, and she moved against him gratefully, her hand finding his and twining in it tightly. May the Lord lift up his face upon you. May he shower his grace upon you. May he cheer your souls and give you peace. Amen. The day was even hotter than Columbus Day had been, and when Alan raised his head, darts of bright sunlight bounced off the casket rails and into his eyes. He wiped his free hand across his forehead, where a solid summer sweat had broken. Polly fumbled with her purse for a fresh Kleenex and wiped her streaming eyes with it. Honey, are you all right? Alan asked. Yes, but I have to cry for her, Alan. Poor Nettie. Poor, poor Nettie. Why did this happen? Why? And she began to sob again. Alan, who wondered exactly the same thing, gathered her into his arms. Over her shoulder, he saw Norris wandering away toward where the cars belonging to Nettie's mourners were huddled, looking like a man who either doesn't know where he is going or who isn't quite awake. Alan frowned. Then Rosalie Drake approached Norris, said something to him, and Norris gave her a hug. Alan thought, he knew her too. He's just sad, that's all. You're jumping at an almighty lot of shadows these days. Maybe the real question here is, what's the matter with you? Then Killingworth was there, and Polly was turning to thank him, getting herself under control. Killingworth held out his hands. With guarded amazement, Alan watched the fearless way Polly allowed her own hand to be swallowed up in the minister's larger ones. He could not remember ever seeing Polly offer one of her hands so freely and unthoughtfully. She's not just a little better. She's a lot better. What in the hell happened? On the other side of the hill, Father John Brigham's nasal, rather irritating voice proclaimed, "Peace be with you, and with you," the mourners replied en masse. Alan looked at the plain gray casket beside that hideous swatch of fake green grass and thought, "Peace be with you, Nettie, now and at last, peace be with you." As the twin funerals at Homeland were winding up, Eddie Warburton was parking in front of Polly's house. He slipped from his car, not a nice new car like the one that honky bastard down at the Sunoco had wrecked, just transportation, and looked cautiously both ways. Everything seemed fine. The street was dozing through what might have been an afternoon in early August. Eddie hurried up Polly's walk, fumbling an official-looking envelope out of his shirt as he went. Mr. Gaunt had called him only 10 minutes ago, telling him it was time to finish paying for his medallion, and here he was, of course. Mr. Gaunt was the sort of guy who, when he said frog, you jumped. Eddie climbed the 3 steps to Polly's porch. A hot little gust of breeze stirred the wind chimes above the door, making them jingle softly together. It was the most civilized sound imaginable, but Eddie jumped slightly anyway. He took another look around, saw no one, then looked down at the envelope again. Addressed to Ms. Patricia Chalmers, pretty hoity-toity. Eddie hadn't the slightest idea that Polly's real first name was Patricia, nor did he care. His job was to do this little trick and then get the hell out of here. He dropped the letter into the mail slot. It fluttered down and landed on top of the other mail, 2 catalogs and a cable TV brochure. Just a business-length envelope with Polly's name and address centered below the metered mail stamp in the upper right corner and the return address in the upper left. San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, 666 Geary Street, San Francisco, California, 94112. What is it? Alan asked as he and Polly walked slowly down the hill toward Alan's station wagon. He had hoped to pass at least a word with Norris, but Norris had already gotten into his VW and taken off. Back to the lake for a little more fishing before the sun went down, probably. Polly looked up at him, still red-eyed and too pale, but smiling tentatively. "What is what?" "Your hands. What's made them all better? It's like magic." "Yes," she said, and held them out before her, splay-fingered, so they could both look at them. "It is, isn't it?" Her smile was a little more natural now. Her fingers were still twisted, still crooked, and the joints were still bunched, but the acute swelling which had been there Friday night was almost completely gone. "Come on, lady, give." "I'm not sure I want to tell you," she said. "I'm a little embarrassed, actually." They stopped and waved at Rosalie as she drove by in her old blue Toyota. "Come on," Alan said, "fess up." "Well," she said, "I guess it was just a matter of finally meeting the right doctor." Slow color was rising in her cheeks. "Who's that?" "Dr. Gaunt," she said with a nervous little laugh. "Dr. Leland Gaunt." "Gaunt?" He looked at her in surprise. "What does he have to do with your hands?" "Drive me down to his shop, and I'll tell you on the way." 5 minutes later, one of the nicest things about living in Castle Rock, Alan sometimes thought, was that almost everything was only 5 minutes away. He swung into one of the slant spaces in front of Needful Things. There was a sign in the window, one Alan had seen before. "Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only." It suddenly occurred to Alan, who hadn't thought about this aspect of the new store at all until now, that "closed except by appointment" was one fuck of a strange way to run a small-town business. "Alan?" Polly asked hesitantly. "You look mad." "I'm not mad," he said. "What in the world do I have to be mad about? The truth is, I don't know how I feel." "I guess." He uttered a short laugh, shook his head, and started again. "I guess I'm what Todd used to call gabra-flasted. Quack remedies? It just doesn't seem like you, Paul." Her lips tightened at once, and there was a warning in her eyes when she turned to look at him. "Quack isn't the word I would have used. Quack is for ducks and prayer wheels from the ads in the back of Inside View. Quack is the wrong word to use if a thing works, Alan. Do you think I'm wrong?" He opened his mouth to say what he wasn't sure, but she went on before he could say anything. "Look at this." She held her hands out in the sunshine flooding through the windshield, then opened them and closed them effortlessly several times. "All right, poor choice of words. What I..." "Yes, I'd say so. A very poor choice." "I'm sorry." She turned all the way around to face him then, sitting where Annie had so often sat, sitting in what had once been the Pangborn family car. "Why haven't I traded this thing yet?" Alan wondered. "What am I, crazy?" Polly placed her hands gently over Alan's. "Oh, this is starting to feel really uncomfortable. We never argue, and I'm not going to start now. I buried a good companion today. I'm not going to have a fight with my boyfriend as well." A slow grin lit his face. "That what I am? Your boyfriend?" "Well, you're my friend. Can I at least say that?" He hugged her, a little astonished at how close they had come to having harsh words. And not because she felt worse, because she felt better. "Honey, you can say anything you want. I love you a bunch. And we're not going to have a fight, no matter what." He nodded solemnly. "No matter what. Because I love you too, Alan." He kissed her cheek, then let her go. "Let me see this ashcan thing he gave you." "It's not an ashcan. It's an Ozka. And he didn't give it to me. He loaned it to me on a trial basis. That's why I'm here, to buy it. I told you that. I just hope he doesn't want the moon and stars for it." Alan looked at the sign in the display window and at the shade pulled down over the door. He thought, "I'm afraid that's just what he is going to want, darling." He didn't like any of this. He had found it hard to take his eyes away from Polly's hands during the funeral service. He had watched her manipulate the catch on her purse effortlessly, dig into her bag for a Kleenex, then close the catch with the tips of her fingers instead of shuffling the bag awkwardly around so she could do it with her thumbs, which were usually a good deal less painful. He knew her hands were better, but this story about a magic charm, and that was what it came down to when you scraped the frosting off the cake, made him extremely nervous. It reeked of confidence game. "Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only." No, except for a few fancy restaurants like Maurice, he hadn't seen a business that kept appointment only hours since he'd come to Maine. And you could walk right off the street and get a table at Maurice 9 times out of 10, except in the summer, of course, when the tourists were spawning. By appointment only. Nevertheless, he had seen, out of the corner of his eye, as it were, people going in and out all week long. Not in droves, maybe, but it was clear that Mr. Gaunt's way of doing business hadn't hurt him any, odd or not. Sometimes his customers came in little groups, but far more often they seemed to be on their own, or so it seemed to Alan now, casting his mind back over the previous week. And wasn't that how con men worked? They split you off from the herd, got you on your own, made you comfortable, and then showed you how you could own the Lincoln Tunnel for this one-time-only low price. Alan, her fist knocked lightly on his forehead. Alan, are you in there? He looked back at her with a smile. I'm here, Polly. She had worn a dark blue jumper with a matching blue stock tie to Nettie's funeral. While Alan was thinking, she had taken off the tie and dexterously unbuttoned the top two buttons of the white blouse underneath. More, he said with a leer. Cleavage. We want cleavage. Stop, she said primly, but with a smile. We're sitting in the middle of Main Street, and it's 2:30 in the afternoon. Besides, we've just come from a funeral, in case you forgot. He started. Is it really that late? If 2:30's late, it's late. She tapped his wrist. Do you ever look at the thing you've got strapped on there? He looked at it now and saw it was closer to 2:40 than 2:30. Middle school broke at 3 o'clock. If he was going to be there when Brian Rusk got out, he had to get moving right away. Let me see your trinket, he said. She grasped the fine silver chain around her neck and pulled out the small silver object on the end of it. She cupped it in her palm, then closed her hand over it when he moved to touch it. I don't know if you're supposed to. She was smiling, but the move he'd made had clearly left her uncomfortable. It might screw up the vibrations or something.
Oh, come on, Paul, he said, annoyed.
Look, she said, let's get something straight, okay? Want to? The anger was back in her voice. She was trying to control it, but it was there. It's easy for you to make light of this. You're not the one with the oversized buttons on the telephone or the oversized Percodan prescription. Hey, Polly, that's... No, never mind, hey, Polly. Bright spots of color had mounted in her cheeks. Part of her anger, she would think later, sprang from a very simple source. On Sunday, she had felt exactly as Alan felt now. Something had happened since then to change her mind, and dealing with that change was not easy. This thing works. I know it's crazy, but it does work. On Sunday morning, when Nettie came over, I was in agony. I'd started thinking about how the real solution to all my problems might be a double amputation. The pain was so bad, Alan, that I turned that thought over with a feeling that was almost surprise, like, oh yeah, amputation. Why haven't I thought of that before? It's so obvious. Now, just 2 days later, all I've got is what Dr. Van Allen calls fugitive pain, and even that seems to be going away. I remember about a year ago I spent a week on a white rice diet because that was supposed to help. Is this so different? The anger had gone out of her voice as she spoke, and now she was looking at him almost pleadingly. I don't know, Polly. I really don't. She had opened her hand again, and now she held the Azka between her thumb and forefinger. Alan bent close to look at it, but made no move to touch it this time. It was a small silver object, not quite round. Tiny holes, not much bigger than the black dots which make up newsprint photographs, studded its lower half. It gleamed mellowly in the sunlight. And as Alan looked at it, a powerful, irrational feeling swept him. He didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. He resisted a brief, powerful urge to simply rip it off Polly's neck and throw it out the open window. Yes, good idea, sport. You do that and you'll be picking your teeth out of your lap. Sometimes it almost feels like something is moving around inside of it, Polly said, smiling. Like a Mexican jumping bean or something. Isn't that silly?
I don't know.
He watched her drop it back inside her blouse with a strong sense of misgiving. But once it was out of sight and her fingers, her undeniably limber fingers, had gone to work rebuttoning the top of her blouse, the feeling began to fade. What didn't was his growing suspicion that Mr. Leland Gaunt was conning the woman he loved. And if he was, she would not be the only one. Have you thought it could be something else? Now he was moving with the delicacy of a man using slick stepping stones to cross a swift-running stream. You've had remissions before, you know. Of course I know, Polly said with edgy patience. They're my hands. Polly, I'm just trying. I knew you'd probably react just the way you are reacting, Alan. The fact is simple enough. I know what arthritic remission feels like, and brother, this isn't it. I've had times over the last 5 or 6 years when I felt pretty good, but I've never felt this good, even during the best of them. This is different. This is like... She paused, thought, then made a small, frustrated gesture that was mostly hands and shoulders. This is like being well again. I don't expect you to understand exactly what I mean, but I can't put it any better than that. He nodded, frowning. He did understand what she was saying, and he also understood that she meant it. Perhaps the Azka had unlocked some dormant healing power in her own mind. Was that possible, even though the disease in question wasn't psychosomatic in origin? The Rosicrucians thought stuff like that happened all the time. So did the millions of people who had bought L. Ron Hubbard's book on Dianetics, for that matter. He himself didn't know. The only thing he could say for sure was that he had never seen a blind person think himself back to sight, or a wounded person stop his bleeding by an effort of concentration. What he did know was this. Something about the situation smelled wrong. Something about it smelled as high as dead fish that have spent 3 days in the hot sun. Let's cut to the chase, Polly said. Trying not to be mad at you is wearing me out. Come inside with me. Talk to Mr. Gaunt yourself. It's time you met him anyway. Maybe he can explain better what the charm does and what it doesn't do. He looked at his watch again. 3:14 now. For a brief moment, he thought of doing as she suggested and leaving Brian Rusk for later. But catching the boy as he came out of school, catching him while he was away from home, felt right. He would get better answers if he talked to him away from his mother, who would hang around them like a lioness protecting her cub, interrupting, perhaps even telling her son not to answer. Yes, that was the bottom line. If it turned out her son had something to hide, or if Mrs. Rusk even thought he did, Alan might find it difficult or impossible to get the information he needed. Here he had a potential con artist. In Brian Rusk, he might have the key that would unlock a double murder. I can't, honey, he said. Maybe a little later today. I have to go over to the middle school and talk to someone, and I ought to do it right away. Is it about Nettie? It's about Wilma Jerzyk, but if my hunch is right, Nettie comes into it, yes. If I find anything out, I'll talk to you later. In the meantime, will you do something for me? Alan, I'm buying it. They're not your hands. No, I expect you to buy it. I want you to pay him by check, that's all. There's no reason why he shouldn't take one. If he's a reputable businessman, that is. You live in town, and you bank right across the street. But if something shakes out funny, you've got a few days to put a stop on payment. I see, Polly said. Her voice was calm, but Alan realized with a sinking feeling that he had finally missed his footing on one of those slippery stepping stones and fallen headlong into the stream. You think he's a crook, don't you, Alan? You think he's going to take the gullible little lady's money, fold his tent, and steal off into the night? I don't know, Alan said evenly. What I do know is that he's only been doing business here in town for a week, so a check seems like a reasonable precaution to take. Yes, he was being reasonable. Polly recognized that. It was that very reasonableness, that stubborn rationality in the face of what seemed to her to be an authentic miracle cure, that was now driving her anger. She fought an urge to begin snapping her fingers in his face, shouting, "Do you see that, Alan? Are you blind?" as she did so. The fact that Alan was right, that Mr. Gaunt should have no problem at all with her check if he was on the up and up, only made her angrier. "Be careful," a voice whispered. "Be careful. Don't be hasty. Turn on brain before throwing mouth in gear. Remember that you'll love this man." But another voice answered, a colder voice, one she barely recognized as her own. "Do I? Do I really?" "All right," she said, tight-lipped, and slid across the seat and away from him. "Thank you for looking after my best interests, Alan. Sometimes I forget how badly I need someone to do that, you see. I'll be sure to write him a check." "Polly?" "No, Alan. No more talk now. I can't not be mad at you any longer today." She opened the door and got out in one lithe gesture. The jumper rode up, revealing a momentarily heart-stopping length of thigh. He started to get out on his own side, wanting to catch her, talk to her, smooth it over, make her see that he had only voiced his doubts because he cared about her. Then he looked at his watch again. It was 3:09. Even if he pushed it, he might miss Brian Rusk. "I'll talk to you tonight," he called out the window. "Fine," she said. "You do that, Alan." She went directly to the door beneath the canopy without turning around. Before he put the station wagon in reverse and backed out into the street, Alan heard the tinkle of a small silver bell.
Miss Chalmers,
Mr. Gaunt cried cheerfully and made a small check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. He was nearing the bottom of it now. Polly's was the last name but one.
Please, Polly, she said. Excuse me.
His smile widened. Polly.
She smiled back at him, but the smile was forced. Now that she was in here, she felt a keen sorrow at the angry way she and Alan had parted. Suddenly she found herself struggling just to keep from bursting into tears.
Miss Chalmers? Polly? Are you feeling unwell? Mr. Gaunt came around the counter. You'll look a trifle pale. His face was furrowed with genuine concern. This is the man Alan thinks is a crook, Polly thought. If he could only see him now.
It's the sun, I think, she said in a voice that was not quite even. It's so warm outside.
But cool in here, he said soothingly. Come, Polly, come and sit down.
He led her, his hand near but not quite touching the small of her back, to one of the red velvet chairs. She sat upon it, knees together.
I happened to be looking out the window, he said, sitting in the chair next to hers and folding his long hands into his lap. It looked to me as if you and the sheriff might be arguing.
It's nothing, she said, but then a single large tear overspilled the corner of her left eye and rolled down her cheek in silent contradiction.
On the contrary, he said, it means a great deal.
She looked up at him, surprised, and Mr. Gaunt's hazel eyes captured hers. Had they been hazel before? She couldn't remember, not for certain. All she knew was that as she looked into them, she felt all the day's misery, poor Nettie's funeral, then the stupid fight she'd had with Alan, begin to dissolve.
It does?
Polly, he said softly, I think everything is going to turn out just fine. If you trust me.
Do you? Do you trust me?
Yes, Polly said, although something inside, something far and faint, cried out a desperate warning. I do. No matter what Alan says, I trust you with all my heart.
Well, that's fine, Mr. Gaunt said. He reached out and took one of Polly's hands. Her face wrinkled in disgust for a moment, and then relaxed into its former blank and dreaming expression.
That's just fine. And your friend the sheriff needn't have worried, you know. Your personal check is just as good as gold with me.
Alan saw he was going to be late unless he turned on the flasher bubble and stuck it on the roof. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want Brian Rusk to see a police car. He wanted him to see a slightly down-at-the-heel station wagon, just like the kind his own dad probably drove. It was too late to make it to the school before it let out for the day. Alan parked at the intersection of Main and School Streets instead. This was the most logical way for Brian to come. He would just have to hope that logic would work somewhere along the line today. Alan got out, leaned against the station wagon's bumper, and felt in his pocket for a stick of chewing gum. He was unwrapping it when he heard the 3 o'clock bell at the middle school, dreamy and distant in the warm air. He decided to talk to Mr. Leland Gaunt of Akron, Ohio, as soon as he finished with Brian Rusk, appointment or no appointment, and just as abruptly changed his mind. He'd call the Attorney General's office in Augusta first, have them check Gaunt's name against the con file. If there was nothing there, they could send the name on to the Laws R&I computer in Washington. Laws, in Allen's opinion, was one of the few good things the Nixon administration had ever done. The first kids were coming down the street now, yelling, skipping, laughing. A sudden idea struck Alan, and he opened the driver's door of the station wagon. He reached across the seat, opened the glove compartment, and pawed through the stuff inside. Todd's joke can of nuts fell out onto the floor as he did so. Alan was about to give up when he found what he wanted. He took it, slammed the glove compartment shut, and backed out of the car. He was holding a small cardboard envelope with a sticker on it that said, The Folding Flower Trick, Blackstone Magic Company, 19 Greer Street, Patterson, New Jersey. From this packet, Alan slipped an even smaller square, a thick block of multicolored tissue paper. He slipped it beneath his watch band. All magicians have a number of palming wells on their persons and about their clothes, and each has his own favorite well. Under the watch band was Alan's. With the famous folding flowers taken care of, Alan went back to watching for Brian Rusk.
He saw a boy on a bike, cutting jazzily in and out through the clots of pint-sized pedestrians, and was alert at once. Then he saw it was one of the Hanlon twins, and allowed himself to relax again. "Slow down, or I'll give you a ticket," Alan growled as the boy shot past. Jay Hanlon looked at him, startled, and almost ran into a tree. He pedaled on at a much more sedate speed. Alan watched him for a moment, amused, then turned back in the direction of the school and resumed his watch for Brian Rusk. Sally Ratcliffe climbed the stairs from her little speech therapy room to the first floor of the middle school 5 minutes after the 3 o'clock bell and walked down the main hall toward the office. The hall was clearing rapidly, as it always did on days when the weather was fair and warm. Outside, droves of kids were shouting their way across the lawn to where the number 2 and number 3 buses idled sleepily at the curb. Sally's low heels clicked and clacked. She was holding a manila envelope in one hand. The name on this envelope, Frank Jewett, was turned in against her gently rounded breast. She paused at room 6, one door down from the office, and looked in through the wire-reinforced glass. Inside, Mr. Jewett was talking to the half-dozen teachers who were involved in coaching fall and winter sports. Frank Jewett was a pudgy little man who always reminded Sally of Mr. Weatherby, the principal in the Archie comics. Like Mr. Weatherby's, his glasses were always sliding down on his nose. Sitting to his right was Alice Tanner, the school secretary. She appeared to be taking notes. Mr. Jewett glanced to his left, saw Sally looking in the window, and gave her one of his prissy little smiles. She raised one hand in a wave and made herself smile back. She could remember the days when smiling had come naturally to her. Next to praying, smiling had been the most natural thing in the world. Some of the other teachers looked over to see who their fearless leader was looking at. So did Alice Tanner. Alice waggled her fingers coyly at Sally, smiling with saccharine sweetness. "They know," Sally thought. "Every one of them knows that Lester and I are history. Irene was so sweet last night, so sympathetic, and so anxious to spill her guts. That little bitch." Sally waggled her fingers right back, feeling her own coy and totally bogus smile stretch her lips. "I hope you get hit by a dump truck on your way home, you hoary-looking thing," she thought, and then walked on, her sensible low heels clicking and clacking. When Mr. Gaunt had called her during her free period and told her it was time to finish paying for the wonderful splinter, Sally had reacted with enthusiasm and a sour kind of pleasure. She sensed that the little joke she had promised to play on Mr. Jewett was a mean one, and that was all right with her. She felt mean today. She put her hand on the office door, then paused. "What's the matter with you?" she wondered suddenly. "You have the splinter, the wonderful, holy splinter, with the wonderful holy vision caught inside it. Aren't things like that supposed to make a person feel better? Calmer? More in touch with God the Father Almighty? You don't feel calmer and more in touch with anyone. You feel like someone filled your head up with barbed wire." "Yes, but that's not my fault, or the splinter's fault," Sally muttered. "That's Lester's fault. Mr. Lester Big Prick Brat." A short girl wearing glasses and heavy braces turned from the pep club poster she'd been studying and glanced curiously at Sally. "What are you looking at, Irvina?" Sally asked. Irvina blinked. "Nothing, Miss Ratcliffe." "Then go look at it someplace else," Sally snapped. "School is out, you know." Irvina hurried down the hall, throwing an occasional distrustful glance back over her shoulder. Sally opened the door to the office and went in. The envelope she carried had been right where Mr. Gaunt had told her it would be, behind the garbage cans outside the cafeteria doors. She had written Mr. Jewett's name on it herself. She took one more quick glance over her shoulder to make sure that little whore Alice Tanner wasn't coming in. Then she opened the door to the inner office, hurried across the room, and laid the manila envelope on Frank Jewett's desk. Now there was the other thing. She opened the top desk drawer and removed a pair of heavy scissors. She bent and yanked on the lower left-hand drawer. It was locked. Mr. Gaunt had told her that might be the case. Sally glanced into the outer office, saw it was still empty, the door to the hallway still shut. Good. Great. She jammed the tips of the scissors into the crack at the top of the locked drawer and levered them up, hard. Wood splintered, and Sally felt her nipples grow strangely, pleasantly hard. This was sort of fun. Scary, but fun. She reseated the scissors. The points went in further this time and levered them up again. The lock snapped and the drawer rolled open on its casters, revealing what was inside. Sally's mouth dropped open in shocked surprise. Then she began to giggle, breathy, stifled sounds that were really closer to screams than to laughter.
"Oh, Mr. Jewett, what a naughty boy you are!"
There was a stack of digest-sized magazines inside the drawer, and Naughty Boy was, in fact, the name of the one on top. The blurry picture on the cover showed a boy of about 9. He was wearing a 50s-style motorcycle cap and nothing else. Sally reached into the drawer and pulled out the magazines. There were a dozen of them, maybe more. Happy Kids, Nude Cuties, Blowing in the Wind, Bobby's Farm World. She looked into one and could barely believe what she was seeing. Where did things like this come from? They surely didn't sell them down at the drugstore, not even on the top rack Reverend Rose sometimes preached about in church, the one with the sign that said, "Only eyes 18 years and older, please." A voice she knew very well suddenly spoke up in her head. "Hurry, Sally. The meeting's almost over, and you don't want to be caught in here, do you?" And then there was another voice as well. A woman's voice, one Sally could almost put a name to. Hearing this second voice was like being on the telephone with someone, while someone else spoke in the background on the other end of the line. "More than fair," this second voice said. "It seems divine." Sally tuned the voice out and did what Mr. Gaunt had told her to do. She scattered the dirty magazines all over Mr. Jewett's office. Then she replaced the scissors and left the room quickly, pulling the door shut behind her. She opened the door of the outer office and peeked out. No one there, but the voices from room 6 were louder now, and people were laughing. They were getting ready to break up. It had been an unusually short meeting. Thank God for Mr. Gaunt, she thought, and slipped out into the hall. She had almost reached the front doors when she heard them coming out of room 6 behind her. Sally didn't look around. It occurred to her that she hadn't thought of Mr. Lester Big Prick Pratt for the last 5 minutes, and that was really fine. She thought she might go home and draw herself a nice bubble bath and get into it with her wonderful splinter and spend the next 2 hours not thinking about Mr. Lester Big Prick Pratt and what a lovely change that would be. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. What did you do in there? What was in that envelope? Who put it there, outside the cafeteria? When? And most important of all, Sally, what are you starting? She stood still for a moment, feeling little beads of sweat form on her forehead and in the hollows of her temples. Her eyes went wide and startled, like the eyes of a frightened doe. Then they narrowed, and she began to walk again. She was wearing slacks, and they chafed at her crotch in a strangely pleasant way that made her think of her frequent necking sessions with Lester. "I don't care what I did," she thought. "In fact, I hope it's something really mean. He deserves a mean trick, looking like Mr. Weatherby but having all those disgusting magazines. I hope he chokes when he walks into his office." "Yes, I hope he fucking chokes," she whispered. It was the first time in her life she had actually said the F-word out loud, and her nipples tightened and began to tingle again. Sally began to walk faster, thinking in some vague way that there might be something else she could do in the bathtub. It suddenly seemed to her that she had a need or two of her own. She wasn't exactly sure how to satisfy them, but she had an idea she could find out. The Lord, after all, helped those who helped themselves. "Does that seem like a fair price?" Mr. Gaunt asked Polly. Polly started to reply, then paused. Mr. Gaunt's attention suddenly seemed to be diverted. He was gazing off into space, and his lips were moving soundlessly, as if in prayer. "Mr. Gaunt?" He started slightly, then his eyes returned to her and he smiled. "Pardon me, Polly. My mind wanders sometimes."
"The price seems more than fair," Polly told him. "It seems divine."
She took her checkbook from her purse and began to write. Every now and then she would wonder vaguely just what she was up to here, and then she would feel Mr. Gaunt's eyes call hers. When she looked up and met them, the questions and doubts subsided again. The check she handed to him was drawn in the amount of $46. Mr. Gaunt folded it neatly and tucked it into the lapel pocket of his sport jacket. "Be sure to fill out the counterfoil," Mr. Gaunt said. "Your Snoopy friend will undoubtedly want to see it."
"He's coming to see you," Polly said, doing exactly as Mr. Gaunt had suggested. "He thinks you're a confidence man."
He's got lots of thoughts and lots of plans, Mr. Gaunt said. But his plans are going to change, and his thoughts are going to blow away like fog on a windy morning. Take my word for it.
You're not going to hurt him, are you?
Me? You do me a very great wrong, Patricia Chalmers. I am a pacifist, one of the world's great pacifists. I wouldn't raise a hand against our sheriff. I just meant he's got business on the other side of the bridge this afternoon. He doesn't know it yet, but he does.
Oh,
now, Polly?
Yes?
Your check does not constitute complete payment for the Azka.
It doesn't?
No. He was holding a plain white envelope in his hands. Polly didn't have the slightest idea where it had come from, but that seemed perfectly all right. In order to finish paying for your amulet, Polly, you have to help me play a little trick on someone.
Alan?
Suddenly, she was as alarmed as a woods rabbit which gets a dry whiff of fire on a hot summer afternoon.
Do you mean Alan?
I most certainly do not, he said. Asking you to play a trick on someone you know, let alone someone you think you love, would be unethical, my dear.
It would?
Yes, although I believe you really ought to think carefully about your relationship with the sheriff, Polly. You may find that it all comes down to a fairly simple choice, a little pain now to save a great deal of pain later. Put another way, those who marry in haste often live to repent in leisure.
I don't understand you.
I know you don't. You'll understand me better, Polly, after you check your mail. You see, I'm not the only one who has attracted his snooping, sniffy nose. For now, let us discuss the small prank I want you to play. The butt of this joke is a fellow whom I have just recently employed. His name is Merrill.
Ace Merrill?
His smile faded. Don't interrupt me, Polly. Don't ever interrupt me when I am speaking. Not unless you want your hands to swell up like inner tubes filled with poison gas. She shrank away from him, her dreamy, dreaming eyes wide.
I'm sorry.
All right. Your apology is accepted, this time. Now listen to me. Listen very carefully. Frank Jewett and Brian McGinley, the middle school's geography teacher and basketball coach, walked from room 6 into the outer office just behind Alice Tanner. Frank was grinning and telling Brian a joke he'd heard earlier that day from a textbook salesman. It had to do with a doctor who was finding it difficult to diagnose a woman's illness. He had narrowed it down to 2 possibles, AIDS or Alzheimer's, but that was as far as he could go. So the gal's husband takes the doctor aside, Frank went on as they walked into the outer office. Alice was bending over her desk, thumbing through a little pile of messages there, and Frank lowered his voice. Alice could be quite the stick when it came to jokes which were even slightly off color. Yeah? Now Brian was also beginning to grin.
Yeah. He's real upset. He says, "Geez, Doc, is that the best you can do? Isn't there some way we can figure out which one she has?"
Alice selected 2 of the pink message forms and started into the inner office with them. She got as far as the doorway and then stopped short, as if she'd walked into an invisible stone wall. Neither of the grinning, middle-aged, small-town white guys noticed.
"Sure, it's easy," the doc says. "Take her about 25 miles into the woods and leave her there. If she finds her way back, don't fuck her."
Brian McGinley gaped foolishly at his boss for a moment, then exploded into hearty guffaws of laughter. Principal Jewett joined him. They were laughing so hard that neither of them heard Alice the first time she called Frank's name. There was no problem the second time. The second time, she nearly shrieked it. Frank hurried over to her. His first thought was vandalism, some stupid piece of juvenile delinquency. "Alice? What?" Then he saw what, and a terrible, glassy fright filled him. His words dried up. He felt the flesh of his testicles crawling madly. His balls seemed to be trying to pull themselves back to where they had come from. It was the magazines, the secret magazines from the bottom drawer. They had been spread all over the office like nightmare confetti. Boys in uniforms, boys in haylofts, boys in straw hats, boys riding hobby horses in ways the manufacturer had never intended.
"What in God's name?"
The voice, hoarse with horror and fascination, came from Frank's left. He turned his head in that direction, the tendons in his neck creaking like rusty screen door springs, and saw Brian McGinley staring at the wild strew of magazines. His eyes were all but falling out of his face.
"A prank,"
he tried to say. A stupid prank, that's all. Those magazines are not mine. You only have to look at me to know that magazines like that would hold no interest for a man of my... His what? He didn't know, and it didn't really matter anyway, because he had lost his ability to speak, entirely lost it. The three adults stood in shocked silence, staring into the office of middle school principal Frank Jewett. A magazine which had been precariously balanced on the edge of the visitor's chair riffled its pages in response to a puff of hot air through the half-open window and then fell to the floor. Saucy young guys, the cover promised. A prank. Yes, I'll say it was a prank, but will they believe me? Suppose the desk drawer was forced. Will they believe me if it was? Mrs. Tanner? A girl's voice asked from behind them. All three of them, Jewett, Tanner, McGinley, whirled around guiltily. Two girls in red and white cheerleading outfits, ninth graders, stood there. Alice Tanner and Brian McGinley moved almost simultaneously to block the view into Frank's office. Frank Jewett himself seemed rooted to the spot, turned to stone. But they moved just a little too late. The cheerleader's eyes widened. One of them, Darlene Vickery, clapped her hands to her small rosebud mouth and stared at Frank Jewett unbelievingly. Frank thought, oh, good. By noon tomorrow, every student in this school will know. By supper tomorrow night, everyone in town will know. You girls leave, Mrs. Tanner said. Someone has played a nasty joke on Mr. Jewett, a very nasty joke, and you are not to say one word. Do you understand? Yes, Mrs. Tanner, Erin McAvoy said. 3 minutes later, she would be telling her best friend, Donna Boylow, that Mr. Jewett's office had been decorated with pictures of boys wearing heavy metal bracelets and little else. Yes, Mrs. Tanner, Darlene Vickery said. 5 minutes later, she would be telling her best friend, Natalie Priest. Go on, Brian McGinley said. He was trying to sound brisk, but his voice was still thick with shock. Off you go. The two girls fled, cheerleader skirts flipping about their sturdy knees. Brian turned slowly to Frank. I think, he began, but Frank paid no notice. He walked into his office, moving slowly, like a man in a dream. He closed the door with the word principal lettered on it in neat black strokes, and slowly began picking up the magazines. Why don't you just give them a written confession? Part of his mind screamed. He ignored the voice. A deeper part of him, the primitive voice of survival, was also speaking. And this part told him that right now he was at his most vulnerable. If he talked to Alice or Brian now, if he tried to explain this, he would hang himself as high as Haman. Alice was knocking on the door. Frank ignored her and continued his dream walk around the office, picking up the magazines he had accumulated over the last 9 years, writing away for them one by one, and picking them up at the post office in Gates Falls, sure each time that the state police or a team of postal inspectors would fall on him like a ton of bricks. None ever had. But now, this. They won't believe they belong to you, the primitive voice said. They won't allow themselves to believe it. To do that would upset too many of their comfy small-town conceptions of life. Once you get yourself under control, you'll be able to put it over, but who would have done something like this? Who could have done something like this? It never occurred to Frank to ask himself what mad compulsion had caused him to bring the magazines here, here of all places, in the first place. There was only one person Frank Jewett could think of, the one person with whom he'd shared his secret life. George T. Nelson, the high school woodshop teacher. George T. Nelson, who, under his bluff macho exterior, was just as gay as old Dad's hatband. George T. Nelson, with whom Frank Jewett had once attended a sort of party in Boston, the sort of party where there were a great many middle-aged men and a small group of undressed boys, the sort of party that could land you in jail for the rest of your life, the sort of party... There was a manila envelope sitting on his desk blotter. His name was written on the center of it. Frank Jewett felt a horrible sinking sensation in the pit of his belly. It felt like an elevator out of control. He looked up and saw Alice and Brian peering in at him, almost cheek to cheek. Their eyes were wide, their mouths open, and Frank thought, "Now I know what it feels like to be a fish in an aquarium." He waved at them, "Go away." They didn't go, and this somehow did not surprise him. This was a nightmare, and in nightmares, things never went the way you wanted them to. That was why they were nightmares. He felt a terrible sense of loss and disorientation, but somewhere beneath it, like a living spark beneath a heap of wet kindling, was a little blue flame of anger. He sat behind his desk and put the stack of magazines on the floor. He saw that the drawer they'd been in had been forced, just as he had feared. He ripped open the envelope and spilled out the contents. Most of them were glossy photographs, photographs of him and George T. Nelson at that party in Boston. They were cavorting with a number of nice young fellows. The oldest of the nice young fellows might have been 12. And in each picture, George T. Nelson's face was obscured, but Frank Jewett's was crystal clear. This did not much surprise Frank either. There was a note in the envelope. He took it out and read it. "Frank, old buddy, sorry to do this, but I have to leave town and have no time to fuck around. I want $2,000. Bring it to my house tonight at 7 o'clock p.m. So far, you can wiggle out of this thing. It will be tough, but no real problem for a slippery bastard like you. But ask yourself how you're going to like seeing copies of these pics nailed up on every phone pole in town, right under those casino night posters. They will run you out of town on a rail, old buddy. Remember, $2,000 at my house by 7:15 at the latest, or you will wish you were born without a dick. Your friend, George." Your friend. Your friend. His eyes kept returning to that closing line with a kind of incredulous, wondering horror. Your motherfucking, backstabbing, Judas-kissing friend. Brian McGinley was still hammering on the door. But when Frank Jewett finally looked up from whatever it was on his desk which had taken his attention, Brian's fist paused in mid-stroke. The principal's face was waxy white except for two bright clown spots of flush on his cheeks. His lips were drawn back from his teeth in a narrow smile. He didn't look in the least like Mr. Weatherby. "My friend," Frank thought. He crumpled the note with one hand as he shoved the glossy photographs back into the envelope with the other. Now the blue spark of anger had turned orange. The wet kindling was catching fire. "I'll be there, all right. I'll be there to discuss this matter with my friend, George T. Nelson." "Yes, indeed," Frank Jewett said. "Yes, indeed." He began to smile. It was going on 3:15, and Alan had decided Brian Rusk must have taken a different route. The flood of home-going students had almost dried up. Then, just as he was reaching into his pocket for his car keys, he saw a lone figure biking down School Street toward him. The boy was riding slowly, seeming almost to trudge over the handlebars, and his head was bent so low Alan couldn't see his face. But he could see what was in the carrier basket of the boy's bike. A Playmate cooler. "Do you understand?" Gaunt asked Polly, who was now holding the envelope. "Yes, I understand. I do." But her dreaming face was puzzled.
"You don't look happy."
"Well, I..."
"Things like the Ozka don't always work very well for people who aren't happy," Mr. Gaunt said. He pointed at the tiny bulge where the silver ball lay against her skin, and again she seemed to feel something shift strangely inside. At the same moment, horrible cramps of pain invaded her hands, spreading like a network of cruel steel hooks. Polly moaned loudly. Mr. Gaunt crooked the finger he had pointed in a come-along gesture. She felt that shift in the silver ball again, more clearly this time, and the pain was gone. "You don't want to go back to the way things were, do you, Polly?" Mr. Gaunt asked in a silky voice.
"No!"
she cried. Her breast was moving rapidly up and down. Her hands began to make frantic washing gestures, one against the other, and her wide eyes never left his.
"Please, no!"
"Because things could go from bad to worse, couldn't they?"
"Yes, yes, they could."
"And nobody understands, do they? Not even the sheriff. He doesn't know what it's like to wake up at 2 a.m. with hell in his hands, does he?" She shook her head and began to weep. "Do as I say, and you'll never have to wake up that way again, Polly. And here is something else. Do as I say, and if anyone in Castle Rock finds out that your child burned to death in a San Francisco tenement, they won't find it out from me." Polly uttered a hoarse, lost cry, the cry of a woman hopelessly ensnarled in a grinding nightmare. Mr. Gaunt smiled. "There are more kinds of hell than one, aren't there, Polly?"
"How do you know about him?"
she whispered.
"No one knows, not even Alan. I told Alan.
I know, because knowing is my business. And suspicion is his, Polly. Alan never believed what you told him. He said, I'm sure he said all kinds of things, but he never believed you. The woman you hired to babysit was a drug addict, wasn't she? That wasn't your fault. But, of course, the things which led to that situation were all a matter of personal choice, Polly, weren't they? Your choice. The young woman you hired to watch Kelton passed out and dropped a cigarette, or maybe it was a joint, into a wastebasket. Hers was the finger that pulled the trigger, you might say. But the gun was loaded because of your pride, your inability to bend your neck before your parents and the other good people of Castle Rock. Polly was sobbing harder now. Yet, is a young woman not entitled to her pride? Mr. Gaunt asked gently. When everything else is gone, is she not at least entitled to this, the coin without which her purse is entirely empty? Polly raised her streaming, defiant face. I thought it was my business, she said. I still do. If that's pride, so what? Yes, he said soothingly, spoken like a champion. But they would have had you back, wouldn't they? Your mother and father? It might not have been pleasant, not with the child always there to remind them, not with the way tongues wag in pleasant little backwaters like this one. But it would have been possible. Yes, and I would have spent every day trying to stay out from under my mother's thumb, she burst out in a furious, ugly voice which bore almost no resemblance to her normal tone. Yes, Mr. Gaunt said in that same soothing voice. So you stayed where you were. You had Kelton, and you had your pride. And when Kelton was dead, you still had your pride, didn't you? Polly screamed in grief and agony and buried her wet face in her hands. It hurts worse than your hands, doesn't it? Mr. Gaunt asked. Polly nodded her head without taking her face out of her hands. Mr. Gaunt put his own ugly, long-fingered hands behind his head and spoke in the tone of one who gives a eulogy. Humanity, so noble, so willing to sacrifice the other fellow. Stop, she moaned. Can't you stop? It's a secret thing, isn't it, Patricia? Yes. He touched her forehead. Polly uttered a gagging moan, but did not draw away. That's one door into hell you'd like to keep locked, isn't it? She nodded inside her hands. Then do as I say, Polly, he whispered. He took one of her hands away from her face and began caressing it. Do as I say and keep your mouth shut. He looked closely at her wet cheeks and her streaming, reddened eyes. A little moo of disgust puckered his lips for a moment. I don't know which makes me sicker, a crying woman or a laughing man. Wipe your goddamn face, Polly. Slowly, dreamily, she took a lace-edged handkerchief from her purse and began to do it. That's good, he said, and rose. I'll let you go home now, Polly. You have things to do. But I want you to know it has been a great pleasure doing business with you. I have always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves. Hey, Brian, want to see a trick? The boy on the bicycle looked up fast, the hair flying off his forehead, and Alan saw an unmistakable expression on his face, naked, unadulterated fear. Trick? The boy said in a trembling voice. What trick? Alan didn't know what the boy was afraid of, but he understood one thing. His magic, which he had relied upon often as an icebreaker with children, had for some reason been exactly the wrong thing this time. Best to get it out of the way as soon as possible and start over again. He held up his left arm, the one with the watch on it, and smiled into Brian Rusk's pale, watchful, frightened face. You'll notice that there's nothing up my sleeve and that my arm goes all the way up to my shoulder. But now, presto! Alan passed his open right hand slowly down his left arm, snapping the little packet effortlessly out from beneath his watch with his right thumb as he did so. As he closed his fist, he slipped the almost microscopic loop that held the packet closed. He clasped his left hand over his right, and when he spread them apart, a large tissue paper bouquet of unlikely flowers bloomed where there had been nothing but thin air a moment before. Alan had done this trick hundreds of times and never better than on this hot October afternoon, but the expected reaction, a moment of stunned surprise followed by a grin that was one part amazement and two parts admiration, didn't dawn on Brian's face. He gave the bouquet a cursory glance. There seemed to be relief in that brief look, as if he had expected the trick to be of a far less pleasant nature, and then returned his gaze to Alan's face. "Pretty neat, huh?" Alan asked. He stretched his lips in a big smile that felt every bit as genuine as his grandfather's dentures. "Yeah," Brian said. "Uh-huh. I can see you're blown away." Alan brought his hands together, deftly collapsing the bouquet again. It was easy. Too easy, really. It was time to buy a new copy of the folding flower trick. They only lasted so long. The tiny spring in this one was getting loose, and the brightly colored paper would soon begin to rip. He opened his hands again, smiling rather more hopefully now. The bouquet was gone, was once more just a small packet of paper under his watch band. Brian Rusk did not return his smile. His face wore no real expression at all. The remnants of his summer tan could not cover the pallor beneath, nor the fact that his complexion was in an unusual state of prepubescent revolt, a scatter of pimples on the forehead, a bigger one by the corner of his mouth, blackheads nesting on either side of his nose. There were purplish shadows under his eyes, as if his last good night's sleep had been a long time ago. "This kid is a long way from right," Alan thought. "There's something badly sprained, maybe even broken here." There seemed to be two likely possibilities. Either Brian Rusk had seen whoever vandalized the Jurzik house, or he had done it himself. It was pay dirt either way, but if it was the second choice, Alan could barely imagine the size and weight of the guilt which must now be harrowing this boy. "That's a great trick, Sheriff Pangborn," Brian said in a colorless, emotionless voice. "Really. Thanks. Glad you liked it. Do you know what I want to talk to you about, Brian?" "I guess I do," Brian said, and Alan was suddenly sure the boy was going to confess to breaking the windows. Right here on this street corner, he was going to confess, and Alan was going to take a giant step toward unraveling what had happened between Nettie and Wilma. But Brian said nothing more. He only looked up at Alan with his tired, slightly bloodshot eyes. "What happened, son?" Alan asked in that same quiet voice. "What happened while you were at the Jurzik's house?" "Don't know," Brian said. His voice was listless. "But I dreamed about it last night. Sunday night, too. I dream about going to that house. Only in my dream, I see what's really making all the noise." "And what's that, Brian?" "A monster," Brian said. His voice did not change, but a large tear had appeared in each of his eyes, growing on the lower arcs of the lids. "In my dream, I knock on the door instead of riding away like I did, and the door opens, and it's a monster, and it eats me up." The tears brimmed, then rolled slowly down the disturbed skin of Brian Rusk's cheeks. And yes, Alan thought, it could be that, too, simple fright, the sort of fright a little kid might feel when he opens the bedroom door at the wrong time and sees his mother and father screwing. Only, because he's too young to know the look of screwing, he thinks they're fighting. Maybe he even thinks, if they're making a lot of noise, that they're trying to kill each other. But it didn't feel right. It was just that simple. It felt as if this kid were lying his head off, in spite of the haggard look in his eyes, the look that said, "I want to tell you everything." What did that mean? Alan didn't know for sure, but experience taught him that the likeliest solution was that Brian knew whoever had thrown the rocks. Maybe it was someone Brian felt obliged to protect. Or maybe the rock thrower knew Brian had seen him, and Brian knew that. Maybe the kid was afraid of reprisals. "A person threw a bunch of rocks into the Jurzik's house," Alan said in a low and, he hoped, soothing voice. "Yes, sir," Brian said, almost sighed. "I guess so. I guess it could have been that. I thought they were fighting, but it could have been someone throwing rocks. Crash, boom, bang."
The whole rhythm section was the Purple Gang, Alan thought, but did not say. You thought they were fighting?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you really thought?
Yes, sir.
Alan sighed. Well, you know what it was now, and you know it was a bad thing to do. Throwing rocks through somebody's windows is a pretty serious business, even if nothing else comes of it.
Yes, sir.
But this time, something else did come of it. You know that, don't you, Brian?
Yes, sir.
Those eyes, looking up at him from that calm, pallid face. Alan began to understand two things. This boy did want to tell him what had happened, but he was almost certainly not going to do so. You look very unhappy, Brian.
Yes, sir?
Yes, sir. Does that mean you are unhappy? Brian nodded, and two more tears spilled from his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. Alan felt two strong, conflicting emotions, deep pity and wild exasperation. What are you unhappy about, Brian? Tell me.
I used to have this really nice dream, Brian said in a voice which was almost too low to hear. It was stupid, but it was nice just the same. It was about Miss Radcliffe, my speech teacher. Now I know it's stupid. I didn't used to know, and that was better. But guess what? I know more than that now.
Those dark, terribly unhappy eyes rose to meet Alan's again.
The dream I have, the one about the monster who throws the rocks. It scares me, Sheriff Pangborn. But what makes me unhappy are the things I know now. It's like knowing how the magician does his tricks.
He nodded his head a little, and Alan could have sworn Brian was looking at the band of his watch.
Sometimes it's better to be dumb. I know that now.
Alan put a hand on the boy's shoulder. Brian, let's cut through the bullshit, all right? Tell me what happened. Tell me what you saw and what you did. I came to see if they wanted their driveway shoveled this winter, the boy said in a mechanical, rote voice that frightened Alan badly. The kid looked like almost any American child of 11 or 12, Converse sneakers, jeans, a T-shirt with Bart Simpson on it. But he sounded like a robot which has been badly programmed and is now in danger of overloading. For the first time, Alan wondered if Brian Rusk had maybe seen one of his own parents throwing rocks at the Jurzik house. I heard noises, the boy was continuing. He spoke in simple declarative sentences, talking as police detectives are trained to talk in court. They were scary noises, bangs and crashes and things breaking. So I rode away as fast as I could. The lady from next door was out on her stoop. She asked me what was going on. I think she was scared, too. Yes, Alan said. Jillian Miss Lebersky. I talked to her. He touched the Playmate cooler, sitting crookedly in the basket of Brian's bike. He was not unaware of the way Brian's lips tightened when he did this. Did you have this cooler with you on Sunday morning, Brian?
Yes, sir, Brian said.
He wiped his cheeks with the back of his hands and watched Alan's face warily. What was in it? Brian said nothing, but Alan thought his lips were trembling. What was in it, Brian? Brian said a little more nothing. Was it full of rocks? Slowly and deliberately, Brian shook his head. No. For the third time, Alan asked, what was in it?
Same thing that's in it now,
Brian whispered. May I open it and see?
Yes, sir, Brian said in his listless voice.
I guess so. Alan rotated the cover to one side and looked into the cooler. It was full of baseball cards. Tops, Fleer, Donruss. Those are my traders. I carry them with me almost everywhere, Brian said.
You carry them with you?
Yes, sir. Why, Brian? Why do you cart a cooler filled with baseball cards around with you?
I told you, they're traders. You never know when you'll get a chance to make a boss trade with someone. I'm still looking for a Joe Foy. He was on the Impossible Dream Team in 67, and a Mike Greenwell rookie card. The Gator's my favorite player.
And now Alan thought he saw a faint, fugitive gleam of amusement in the boy's eyes. Could almost hear a telepathic voice chanting, "Fooled ya! Fooled ya!" But surely that was only him, only his own frustration mocking the boy's voice. Wasn't it? Well, what did you expect to find inside that cooler anyway? A pile of rocks with notes tied around them? Did you actually think he was on his way to do the same thing to someone else's house? Yes, he admitted. Part of him had thought that, or something like that, was exactly what was going on. Brian Rusk, the pint-sized terror of Castle Rock. The mad rocker.
And the worst part was this. He was pretty sure Brian Rusk knew what was going through his head.
Fooled you, Sheriff.
Brian, please tell me what's going on around here. If you know, please tell me. Brian closed the lid of the Playmate cooler and said nothing. It made a soft little snick in the drowsy autumn afternoon. Can't say? Brian nodded slowly, meaning, Alan thought, that he was right. He couldn't say. Tell me this, at least. Are you scared? Are you scared, Brian? Brian nodded again, just as slowly. Tell me what you're scared of, son. Maybe I can make it go away. He tapped one finger lightly against the badge he wore on the left side of his uniform shirt. I think that's why they pay me to lug this star around, because sometimes I can make the scary stuff go away. Brian began, and then the police radio Alan had installed beneath the dash of the town and country wagon 3 or 4 years ago squawked to life. Unit 1, this is base. Do you copy? Over. Brian's eyes broke away from Alan's. They turned toward the station wagon and the sound of Sheila Brigham's voice, the voice of authority, the voice of the police. Alan saw that if the boy had been on the verge of telling him something, and it might only be wishful thinking to believe he had been, he wasn't anymore. His face had closed up like a clamshell. You go on home now, Brian. We're going to talk about this dream of yours more later on, okay?
Yes, sir, Brian said. I guess so.
In the meantime, think about what I said. Most of what being sheriff's about is making the scary stuff go away.
I have to go home now, Sheriff. If I don't get home pretty soon, my mom's going to be mad at me.
Alan nodded. Well, we don't want that. Go on, Brian.
He watched the boy go. Brian's head was down, and once again, he did not seem to be riding the bike so much as trudging along with it between his legs.
Something was wrong there, so wrong that Alan's finding out what had happened to Wilma and Nettie seemed secondary to finding out what had put that tired, haunted expression on the kid's face. The women, after all, were dead and buried. Brian Rusk was still alive. He went to the tired old station wagon he should have traded a year ago, leaned in, grabbed the Radio Shack mic, and depressed the transmit button. Yeah, Sheila, this is Unit 1. I copy. Come on back.
Henry Payton called for you, Alan, Sheila said. He told me to tell you it's urgent. He wants me to patch you through to him. 10-4?
Go for it, Alan said. He felt his pulse pick up.
It may take a couple of minutes. 10-4?
That's fine. I'll be right here. Unit 1 clear.
He leaned against the side of the car in the dappled shade, mic in hand, waiting to see what was urgent in Henry Payton's life.
By the time Polly reached home, it was 3:20, and she felt torn in two completely different directions. On one hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to be about the errand Mr. Gaunt had given her. She didn't like to think of it in his terms as a prank. Polly Chalmers was not much of a prankster. To get it done so the Osga would finally belong to her. The concept that the dealing wasn't done until Mr. Gaunt said the dealing was done had not so much as crossed her mind. On the other hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to get in touch with Alan, to tell him exactly what had happened, or as much of it as she could remember. One thing she could remember, it filled her with shame and a low sort of horror, but she could remember it all right, was this. Mr. Leland Gaunt hated the man Polly loved, and Mr. Gaunt was doing something that was very wrong. Alan should know. Even if the Osga stopped working, he should know. You don't mean that. But yes, part of her meant exactly that. The part that was terrified of Leland Gaunt, even though she couldn't remember what exactly he had done to induce that feeling of terror. Do you want to go back to the way things were, Polly? Do you want to go back to owning a pair of hands that feel full of shrapnel? No, but neither did she want Alan hurt. Neither did she want Mr. Gaunt to do whatever he was planning to do, if it was something she suspected it was, that would hurt the town. Nor did she want to be a part of that something, by going out to the old deserted Camber place at the end of Town Road Number 3 and playing some sort of trick she didn't even understand. So these conflicting wants, each championed by its own hectoring voice, pulled at her as she walked slowly home. If Mr. Gaunt had hypnotized her in some way, she had been positive of this when she left the store, but she became less and less sure as time passed. The effects had worn off now. Polly really believed this. And she had never in her life found herself so incapable of deciding what to do next. It was as if her whole supply of some vital decision-making chemical had been stolen from her brain. In the end, she went home to do what Mr. Gaunt had advised, although she no longer precisely remembered the advice. She would check her mail, and then she would call Alan and tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted her to do. "If you do that," the interior voice said grimly, "the Oscar really will stop working, and you know it." Yes, but there was still the question of right and wrong. There was still that. She would call Alan and apologize for being so short with him, and then tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted of her. Perhaps she would even give him the envelope Mr. Gaunt had given her, the one she was supposed to put in the tin can. Perhaps. Feeling a little better, Polly put her key in the front door of her house, again rejoicing at the ease of this operation, almost without being aware of it, and turned it. The mail was in its usual place on the carpet. Not very much today. Usually there was more junk mail after the post office had taken a day off. She bent and picked it up, a cable TV brochure with Tom Cruise's smiling, impossibly handsome face on the front, one catalog from the Horchow collection and another from the Sharper Image. Also, Polly saw the one letter, and a ball of dread began to grow deep in her stomach. To Patricia Chalmers of Castle Rock, from the San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, from 666 Geary. She remembered 666 Geary so very well from her trips down there. Three trips in all. Three interviews with three aid to dependent children bureaucrats, two of whom had been men. Men who had looked at her the way you looked at a candy wrapper that had gotten stuck on one of your best shoes. The third bureaucrat had been an extremely large black woman, a woman who had known how to listen and how to laugh, and it was from this woman that Polly had finally gotten an approval. But she remembered 666 Geary, second floor, so very, very well. She remembered the way the light from the big window at the end of the hall had lain a long, milky stain on the linoleum. She remembered the echoey sound of typewriters from offices where the doors always stood open. She remembered the cluster of men smoking cigarettes by the sand-filled urn at the far end of the hall, and how they had looked at her. Most of all, she remembered how it had felt to be dressed in her one good outfit. A dark polyester pantsuit, a white silk blouse, legs, nearly nude pantyhose, her low heels, and how terrified and lonely she had felt, for the dim second-floor corridor of 666 Geary seemed to be a place with neither heart nor soul. Her ADC application had finally been approved there, but it was the turndown she remembered, of course, the eyes of the men, how they had crawled across her breasts. They were better dressed than Norval down at the diner, but otherwise, she thought, not really much different. The mouths of the men, how they had pursed in decorous disapproval as they considered the problem of Kelton Chalmers, the bastard offspring of this little trollop, this Janie come lately, who didn't look like a hippie now, oh no, but who would undoubtedly take off her silk blouse and nice pantsuit as soon as she got out of here, not to mention her brassiere, and put on a pair of tight bell-bottom jeans and a tie-dyed blouse that would showcase her nipples. Their eyes said all that and more, and although the response of the department had come in the mail, Polly had known immediately that she would be turned down. She had wept as she left the building on each of those first two occasions, and it seemed to her now that she could remember the acid trickle of each tear as it slid down her cheek, that and the way the people on the street had looked at her. No caring in their eyes, just a certain dull curiosity. She had never wanted to think about those times or that dim second-floor hallway again, but now it was back with her. So clearly she could smell the floor polish, could see the milky reflected light from the big window, could hear the echoey, dreamy sound of old manual typewriters chewing through another day in the bowels of the bureaucracy. What did they want? Dear God, what could the people at 666 Geary want with her at this late date? "Tear it up!" a voice inside nearly screamed, and the command was so imperative that she came very close to doing just that. She ripped the envelope open instead. There was a single sheet of paper inside. It was a Xerox, and although the envelope had been addressed to her, she saw with astonishment that the letter was not. It was addressed to Sheriff Alan Pangborn. Her eyes dropped to the foot of the letter. The name typed below the scrawled signature was John L. Perlmutter, and this name rang a very faint bell for her. Her eyes dropped a little further, and she saw, at the very foot of the letter, the notation CC Patricia Chalmers. Well, this was a Xerox, not a carbon, but it still cleared up the puzzling matter of this being Alan's letter, and settled her first confused idea that it had been delivered to her by mistake. But what, in God's name? Polly sat on the shaker bench in the hallway and began to read the letter. As she did so, a remarkable series of emotions lensed across her face, like cloud formations on an unsettled, windy day. Puzzlement, understanding, shame, horror, anger, and finally, fury. She screamed aloud once, "No!" and then went back and forced herself to read the letter again, slowly, all the way to the end. San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, 666 Geary Street, San Francisco, California, 94112, September 23, 1991. Sheriff Alan J. Pangborn, Castle County Sheriff's Office, 2 The Municipal Building, Castle Rock, Maine, 04055. Dear Sheriff Pangborn, I am in receipt of your letter of September 1 and am writing to tell you I can offer you no help whatever in this matter. It is the policy of this department to give out information on applicants for Aid to Dependent Children, ADC, only when we are compelled to do so by a valid court order. I have shown your letter to Martin D. Chung, our chief legal counsel, who instructs me to tell you that a copy of your letter has been forwarded to the California Attorney General's office. Mr. Chung has asked for an opinion as to whether your request may be illegal in and of itself. Whatever the result of that inquiry, I must tell you that I find your curiosity about this woman's life in San Francisco to be both inappropriate and offensive. I suggest, Sheriff Pangborn, that you lay this matter to rest before you incur legal difficulties. Sincerely, John L. Perlmutter, Deputy Director, CC, Patricia Chalmers. After her fourth reading of this terrible letter, Polly rose from the bench and walked into the kitchen. She walked slowly and gracefully, more like one who swims than one who walks. At first her eyes were dazed and confused, but by the time she had taken the handset from the wall-mounted phone and tapped out the number of the sheriff's office on the oversized pads, they had cleared. The look which lit them was simple and unmistakable, an anger so strong it was nearly hate. Her lover had been sniffing around in her past. She found the idea simultaneously unbelievable and strangely, hideously plausible. She had done a lot of comparing herself to Alan Pangborn in the last 4 or 5 months, and that meant she had done a lot of coming off second best. His tears, her deceptive calm, which hid so much shame and hurt and secret, defiant pride. His honesty, her little stack of lies, how saint-like he had seemed, how dauntingly perfect, how hypocritical her own insistence that he put the past away. And all the time he had been sniffing around, trying to find out the real story of Kelton Chalmers. "You bastard," she whispered, and as the telephone began to ring, the knuckles of the hand holding the telephone turned white with strain. Lester Pratt usually left Castle Rock High in the company of several friends. They would all go down to Hemp Hill's Market for sodas, then head off to someone's house or apartment for a couple of hours to sing hymns or play games or just shoot the bull. Today, however, Lester left school alone with his knapsack on his back. He disdained the traditional teacher's briefcase and his head down. If Alan had been there to watch Lester walk slowly across the school lawn toward the faculty parking lot, he would have been struck by the man's resemblance to Brian Rusk. 3 times that day, Lester had tried to get in touch with Sally to find out what in the land of Goshen had made her so mad. The last time had been during his Period 5 lunch break. He knew she was at the middle school, but the closest he got to her was a callback from Mona Lawless, who taught 6th and 7th grade math and chummed with Sally. "She can't come to the phone," Mona told him, displaying all the warmth of a deep freeze stuffed with popsicles. "Why not?" he had asked, almost whined. "Come on, Mona, give." "I don't know." Mona's voice had progressed from popsicles in the deep freeze to the verbal equivalent of liquid nitrogen. "All I know is that she's been staying with Irene Lutjens. She looks like she spent all last night crying, and she says she doesn't want to talk to you." And this is all your fault, Mona's frozen tone said. I know that because you're a man, and all men are dog shit. This is just another specific example illustrating the general case.
Well, I don't have the slightest idea what it's all about, Lester shouted. Will you tell her that, at least? Tell her I don't know why she's mad at me. Tell her whatever it is, it must be a misunderstanding, because I don't get it.
There was a long pause. When Mona spoke again, her voice had warmed up a little. Not much, but it was a lot better than liquid nitrogen. All right, Lester. I'll tell her. Now he raised his head, half hoping Sally might be sitting in the passenger seat of the Mustang, ready to kiss and make up. But the car was empty. The only person close to it was soft-headed Slopey Dodd, goofing around on his skateboard. Steve Edwards came up behind Lester and clapped him on the shoulder. Les boy, want to come over to my place for coke? A bunch of the guys said they'd drop by. We have to talk about this outrageous Catholic harassment. The big meeting's at the church tonight, don't forget, and it would be good if we YAs could present a united front when it comes to deciding what to do. I mentioned the idea to Don Hemphill, and he said, yeah, great, go for it. He looked at Lester as if he expected a pat on the head. I can't this afternoon, Steve. Maybe another time.
Hey, Les, don't you get it? There may not be another time. The Pope's boys aren't fooling around anymore.
I can't come over, Les said. And if you're wise, his face said, you'll stop pushing it.
Well, but why not?
Because I have to find out what the heck I did to make my girl so angry, Lester thought. And I am going to find out, even if I have to shake it out of her. Out loud, he said, I've got stuff to do, Steve. Important stuff. Take my word for it.
If this is about Sally, Les...
Lester's eyes flashed dangerously. You just shut up about Sally. Steve, an inoffensive young man who had been set aflame by the strife over casino night, was not yet burning brightly enough to overstep the line Lester Pratt had so clearly drawn. But neither was he quite ready to give up. Without Lester Pratt, a young adult's policy meeting was a joke, no matter how many from the YA group turned out. Pitching his voice more reasonably, he said, You know the anonymous card Bill got? Yes, Lester said. Reverend Rose had found it on the floor of the parsonage front hallway, the already notorious Baptist Ratfuck card. The Reverend had passed it around at a hastily called Guys Only, YA meeting, because, he said, it was impossible to credit unless you saw the vile thing for yourself. It was hard to fully understand, Reverend Rose had added, the depths to which the Catholics would sink in order to stifle righteous opposition to their Satan-inspired night of gambling. Perhaps actually seeing this vile spew of filth would help these fine young men comprehend what they were up against. For do we not say that the forewarned is forearmed? Reverend Rose had finished grandly. He then produced the card. It was inside a baggie, as if those who handled it needed to be guarded from infection, and handed it around. As Lester finished reading it, he had been more than ready to ring a few sets of Catholic chimes, but now the entire affair seemed distant and somehow childish. Who really cared if the Catholics gambled for play money and gave away a few new tires and kitchen appliances? When it came down to a choice between the Catholics and Sally Ratcliffe, Lester knew which one he had to worry about.
A meeting to try and work out the next step, Steve was continuing. He was starting to get hot again. We have to seize the initiative here, Les. We have to. Reverend Bill says he's worried that these so-called concerned Catholic men are through talking. Their next step may be,
Look, Steve, do whatever you want, but leave me out of it. Steve stopped and stared at him, clearly shocked, and just as clearly expecting Lester, normally the most even-tempered of fellows, to come to his senses and apologize. When he realized no apology was forthcoming, he started to walk back toward the school, putting distance between himself and Lester.
Boy, you're in a rotten mood, he said.
That's right, Lester called back truculently. He rolled his big hands into fists and planted them on his hips. But Lester was more than just angry. He hurt, damn it. He hurt all over. And what hurt the worst was his mind. And he wanted to strike out at someone. Not poor old Steve Edwards. It was just that allowing himself to get pissed at Steve seemed to have turned on a switch inside him. That switch had sent electricity flowing to a lot of mental appliances which were usually dark and silent. For the first time since he'd fallen in love with Sally, Lester, normally the most placid of men, felt angry at her, too. What right had she to tell him to go to hell? What right did she have to call him a bastard? She was mad about something, was she? All right, she was mad. Maybe he had even given her something to be mad about. He hadn't the slightest idea what that something might be, but say, just for the sake of argument, that he had. Did that give her the right to fly off the handle at him without even doing him the courtesy of asking for an explanation first? Did it give her the right to stay with Irene Lujan so he couldn't crash his way into wherever she was, or to refuse all his telephone calls, or to employ Mona Lawless as a go-between? I'm going to find her, Lester thought, and I'm going to find out what's eating her. Then, once it's out, we can make up. And after we do, I'm going to give her the same lecture I give my freshmen when basketball practice starts, about how trust is the key to teamwork. He stripped off his pack, chucked it into the back seat, and climbed into his car. As he did, he saw something sticking out from under the passenger seat. Something black. It looked like a wallet. Lester seized it eagerly, thinking at first that it must be Sally's. If she had left it in his car at some point during the long holiday weekend, she must have missed it by now. She'd be anxious. And if he could relieve her anxiety about her lost wallet, the rest of their conversation might become a little easier. But it wasn't Sally's. He saw that as soon as he got a close look at the item which had been under the passenger seat. It was black leather. Sally's was scuffed blue suede and much smaller. Curiously, he opened it. The first thing he saw struck him like a hard blow to the solar plexus. It was John LaPointe's driver's license. What, in the name of God, had John LaPointe been doing in his car? Sally had it all weekend, his mind whispered. So just what the hell do you think he was doing in your car? No, he said. Uh-uh, no way. She wouldn't. She wouldn't see him. No way in hell. But she had seen him. She and Deputy John LaPointe had gone out together for over a year, in spite of the developing bad feelings between Castle Rock's Catholics and Baptists. They had broken up before the current hoorah over casino night, but... Lester got out of the car again and flipped through the wallet's see-through pockets. His sense of incredulity grew. Here was LaPointe's sheriff's office ID. In the picture on it, he was wearing the little mustache he'd cultivated when he'd been going out with Sally. Lester knew what some fellows called mustaches like that. Pussy ticklers. Here was John LaPointe's fishing license. Here was a picture of John LaPointe's mother and father. Here was his hunting license. And here? Here? Lester stared fixedly at the snapshot he'd come upon. It was a snapshot of John and Sally. A snap of a fellow and his best girl. They were standing in front of what looked like a carnival shooting gallery. They were looking at each other and laughing. Sally was holding a big stuffed teddy bear. LaPointe had probably just won it for her. Lester stared at the picture. A vein had risen in the center of his forehead, quite a prominent one, and it pulsed steadily. What had she called him? A cheating bastard? Well, look who's talking, Lester Pratt muttered. Rage began to build up in him. It happened very quickly, and when someone touched him on the shoulder, he swung around, dropping the wallet and doubling up his fists. He came very close to punching inoffensive, stuttering Slopey Dodd into the middle of next week. Coach Pratt? Slopey asked. His eyes were big and round, but he didn't look frightened. Interested, but not frightened. Are you okay? I'm fine. Lester said thickly. Go home, Slopey. Put an egg in your shoe and beat it. You don't have any business with that skateboard in the faculty parking lot. He bent down to pick up the dropped wallet, but Slopey was 2 feet closer to the ground and beat him to it. He looked curiously at LaPointe's driver's license photo before handing the wallet back to Coach Pratt. Yep, Slopey said. That's the same guy, all right. He hopped onto his board and prepared to ride away. Lester grabbed him by the shirt before he could do so. The board squirted out from under Slopey's foot, rolled away on its own, hit a pothole, and turned over. Slopey's AC/DC shirt, for those about to rock, we salute you, it said, tore at the neck, but Slopey didn't seem to mind, didn't even seem to be much surprised by Lester's actions, let alone frightened. Lester didn't notice. Lester was beyond noticing nuances. He was one of those large and normally placid men who own a short, nasty temper beneath that placidity, a damaging emotional tornado in waiting. Some men go through their entire lives without ever discovering that ugly storm center.
Lester, however, had discovered his, or rather, it had discovered him, and he was now completely in its grip. Holding a swatch of Slopey's T-shirt in a fist which was nearly the size of a daisy canned ham, he bent his sweating face down towards Slopey's. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing faster than ever. "What do you mean, that's the same guy, all right?" "He's the same guy who met Miss Ratcliffe after school last Friday."
"He met her after school?"
Lester asked hoarsely. He gave Slopey a shake brisk enough to rattle the boy's teeth in his head.
"Are you sure of that?"
"Yeah," Slopey said. "They went off in your car, Coach Pratt. The guy was driving."
"Driving?
He was driving my car? John LaPointe was driving my car with Sally in it?"
"Well, that guy," Slopey said, pointing at the driver's license photograph again. "But before they got in, he gave her a kiss."
"Did he?" Lester said. His face had become very still. "Did he now?"
"Oh, sure, Slopey said. A wide and rather salacious grin lit his face.
In a soft, silky tone, utterly unlike his usual rough, "Hey guys, let's go get 'em" voice, Lester asked, "And did she kiss him back? What do you think, Slopey?"
Slopey rolled his eyes happily. "I'll say she did. They were really sucking face, Coach Pratt."
"Sucking face," Lester mused in his new soft and silky voice.
"Yep.
Really sucking face," Lester marveled in his new soft and silky voice.
"You bet."
Lester let go of the Slopester, as his friends called him, and straightened up. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing and pumping away. He had begun to grin. It was an unpleasant grin, exposing what seemed like a great many more white, square teeth than a normal man should have. His blue eyes had become small, squinty triangles. His crew cut screamed off his head in all directions.
"Coach Pratt?" Slopey asked. "Is something wrong?"
"Nope," Lester Pratt said in his new soft and silky voice. His grin never wavered. "Nothing I can't put right." In his mind, his hands were already locked around the neck of that lying, pope-loving, teddy-bear-winning, girl-stealing, shit-eating, French frog of a John LaPointe. The asshole that walked like a man. The asshole who had apparently taught the girl Lester loved. The girl who would do no more than part her lips the tiniest bit when Lester kissed her. How to really suck face. First, he would take care of John LaPointe. No problem there. Once that was done, he'd have to talk to Sally. Or something. "Not a thing in the world I can't put right," he repeated in his new soft and silky voice, and slid back behind the Mustang's wheel. The car leaned appreciably to the left as Lester's 210 pounds of solid hock and loin settled into the bucket seat. He started the engine, gunned it in a series of hungry tiger cage roars, then drove away in a screech of rubber. The Slopester, coughing and theatrically waving dust away from his face, walked over to where his skateboard lay. The neck of his old T-shirt had been torn completely away from the shirt's body, leaving what looked like a round black necklace lying over Slopey's prominent collarbones. He was grinning. He had done just what Mr. Gaunt had asked him to do, and it had gone like gangbusters. Coach Pratt hadn't looked madder than a wet hen. Now he could go home and look at his teapot.
"I just wish I didn't have to stutter, he remarked to no one in particular.
Slopey mounted his skateboard and rode away. Sheila had a hard time connecting Alan with Henry Payton. Once she was positive she'd lost Henry, who sounded really excited, and would have to call him back. And she had no more than accomplished this technological feat when Alan's personal line lit up. Sheila put aside the cigarette she'd been about to light and answered it. "Castle County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Pangborn's line." "Hello, Sheila. I want to talk to Alan."
"Polly?"
Sheila frowned. She was sure that was who it was, but she had never heard Polly Chalmers sound exactly as she did now, cold and clipped, like an executive secretary in a big company.
"Is that you?" Yes, Polly said. I want to talk to Alan. Gee, Polly, you can't. He's talking with Henry Payton right now. Put me on hold, Polly interrupted. I'll wait.
Sheila began to feel flustered. Well, I would, but it's a little more complicated than that. You see, Alan's, you know, in the field. I had to patch Henry through.
If you can patch Henry Payton through, you can patch me through, Polly said coldly.
Right?
Well, yes, but I don't know how long they'll be.
I don't care if they talk until hell freezes over, Polly said. Put me on hold, and when they're done, patch me through to Alan. I wouldn't ask you to do it if it weren't important. You know that, Sheila, don't you?
Yes, Sheila knew it, and she knew something else, too. Polly was beginning to scare her. Polly, are you okay?
There was a long pause. Then Polly answered with a question of her own.
Sheila, did you type any correspondence for Sheriff Pangborn that was addressed to the Department of Child Welfare in San Francisco, or see any envelopes addressed that way go out?
Red lights, a whole series of them, suddenly went on in Sheila's mind. She nearly idolized Alan Pangborn, and Polly Chalmers was accusing him of something. She wasn't sure what, but she knew the tone of accusation when she heard it. She knew it very well.
That isn't the sort of information I could give out to anyone, she said, and her own tone had dropped 20 degrees. I suppose you'd better ask the sheriff, Polly.
Yes, I guess I'd better. Put me on hold and connect me when you can, please.
Polly, what's wrong? Are you angry at Alan? Because you must know he'd never do anything that was...
I don't know anything anymore, Polly said. If I asked you something that was out of line, I'm sorry. Now, will you put me on hold and connect me as soon as you can, or do I have to go out and find him for myself?
No, I'll connect you, Sheila said.
Her heart felt strangely troubled, as if something terrible had happened. She, like many of the women in Castle Rock, had believed Alan and Polly were deeply in love, and like many of the other women in town, Sheila tended to see them as characters in a dark-tinged fairy tale where everything would come right in the end. Somehow, love would find a way. But now Polly sounded more than angry. She sounded full of pain and something else as well. To Sheila, the something else sounded almost like hate.
You're going on hold now, Polly. It may be a while.
That's fine. Thanks, Sheila.
Welcome.
She pushed the hold button and then found her cigarette. She lit it and dragged deeply, looking at the small, flickering light with a frown.
Alan? Henry Payton called. Alan, you there?
His voice had the flat, nasal quality voices always have when they are coming through a patch. He sounded like an announcer broadcasting from inside a large, empty saltines box.
Right here, Henry.
I got a call from the FBI just half an hour ago, Henry said from inside his cracker box. We caught an incredibly lucky break on those prints.
Alan's heartbeat kicked into a higher gear.
The ones on the doorknob of Nettie's house? The partials?
Right. We have a tentative match with a fellow right there in town. One prior, petty larceny in 1977. We've also got his service prints.
Now, don't keep me hanging. Who is it?
The name of the individual is Hugh Albert Priest.
Hugh Priest! Alan exclaimed.
He could not have been more surprised if Payton had named J. Danforth Quayle. To the best of Alan's knowledge, the two men had known Nettie Cobb equally well.
Why would Hugh Priest kill Nettie's dog, or break Wilma Jerzyk's windows, for that matter?
I don't know the gentleman, so I can't say, Henry replied.
Why don't you pick him up and ask him?
In fact, why don't you do it right away before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota?
Good idea, Alan said. I'll talk to you later, Henry.
Thanks.
Just keep me updated, Scout. This is supposed to be my case, you know.
Yeah. I'll talk to you.
There was a sharp, metallic sound, bink, as the connection broke, and then Alan's radio was transmitting the open hum of a telephone line. Alan wondered briefly what 9X and AT&T would think of the games they were playing, then bent to rack the mic. As he did so, the telephone line hum was broken by Sheila Brigham's voice, her uncharacteristically hesitant voice.
Sheriff, I have Polly Chalmers on hold. She's asked to be patched through to you as soon as you're available. 10-4?
Alan blinked.
Polly?
He was suddenly afraid, the way you're afraid when the telephone rings at 3 in the morning. Polly had never asked for such a service before, and if asked, Alan would have said she never would. It would have gone against her idea of correct behavior, and to Polly, correct behavior was very important.
What is it, Sheila? Did she say 10-4?
No, Sheriff, 10-4.
No, of course she hadn't. He had known that, too. Polly didn't spread her business around.
The fact that he'd even asked showed how surprised he was. Sheriff? Pass her through, Sheila. 10-4. 10:40, Sheriff.
Bink.
He stood there in the sunshine, his heart beating too hard and too fast. He didn't like this. The bink sound came again, followed by Sheila's voice, distant, almost lost.
Go ahead, Polly. You should be connected.
Alan?
The voice was so loud he recoiled. It was the voice of a giant, an angry giant. He knew that much already. One word was enough.
I'm here, Polly. What is it?
For a moment, there was only silence. Somewhere, deep within it, was the faint mutter of other voices on other calls. He had time to wonder if he had lost the connection, time to almost hope he had.
Alan, I know this line is open, she said, but you'll know what I'm talking about.
How could you? How could you?
Something was familiar about this conversation. Something.
Polly, I'm not understanding you.
Oh, I think you are, she replied.
Her voice was growing thicker, harder to understand, and Alan realized that if she wasn't crying, she soon would be.
It's hard to find out you don't know a person you thought you did. It's hard to find out the face you thought you loved is only a mask.
Something familiar, right, and now he knew what it was. This was like the nightmares he'd had following the deaths of Annie and Todd, the nightmares in which he stood on the side of the road and watched them go past in the scout. They were on their way to die. He knew it, but he was helpless to change it. He tried to wave his arms, but they were too heavy. He tried to shout and couldn't remember how to open his mouth. They drove by him as if he were invisible, and this was like that, too, as if he had become invisible to Polly in some weird way.
Annie, he realized with horror whose name he had said and backtracked. Polly, I don't know what you're talking about, Polly, but...
You do! She screamed at him suddenly. Don't say you don't when you do. Why couldn't you wait for me to tell you, Alan? And if you couldn't wait, why couldn't you ask? Why did you have to go behind my back? How could you go behind my back?
He shut his eyes tight in an effort to catch hold of his racing, confused thoughts, but it did no good. A hideous picture came instead. Mike Horton from the Norway Journal Register bent over the newspaper's Bearcat scanner, furiously taking notes in his pigeon shorthand.
I don't know what it is you think I've done, but you've got it wrong. Let's get together. Talk.
No, I don't think I can see you now, Alan.
Yes, you can, and you're going to. I'll be...
Then Henry Peyton's voice cut in. Why don't you do it right away, before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota?
You'll be what?
She was asking.
You'll be what?
I just remembered something, Alan said slowly.
Oh, did you?
Was it a letter you wrote at the beginning of September, Alan? A letter to San Francisco?
I don't know what you're talking about, Polly. I can't come now because there's been a break in the other thing. But later...
She spoke to him through a series of gasping sobs that should have made her hard to understand, but didn't.
Don't you get it, Alan? There is no later. Not anymore. You...
Polly, please.
No! Just leave me alone. Leave me alone, you snooping, prying son of a bitch!
Bink!
And suddenly, Alan was listening to that open telephone line hum again. He looked around the intersection of Main and School, like a man who doesn't know where he is and has no clear understanding of how he got there. His eyes had the faraway, puzzled expression often seen in the eyes of fighters in the last few seconds before their knees come unhinged and they go sprawling to the canvas for a long winter's nap. How had this happened? And how had it happened so quickly? He hadn't the slightest idea. The whole town seemed to have gone slightly nuts in the last week or so, and now Polly was infected, too.
Bink!
Sheriff?
It was Sheila, and Alan knew from her hushed, tentative tone that she'd had her ears on during at least part of his conversation with Polly.
Alan? Are you there? Come back?
He felt a sudden urge, amazingly strong, to rip the mic out of its socket and throw it into the bushes beyond the sidewalk, then drive away, anywhere, just stop thinking about everything and drive down the sun. Instead, he gathered all his forces and made himself think of Hugh Priest. That's what he had to do, because it now looked as if maybe Hugh had brought about the deaths of two women. Hugh was his business right now, not Polly, and he discovered a great sense of relief hiding in that. He pushed the transmit button. Here, Sheila. 10-4. Alan, I think I lost the connection with Polly. I didn't mean to listen, but...
That's okay, Sheila. We were done. There was something horribly final about what he just said, but he refused to think of it now.
Who's there with you right now? 10-4?
John's catching, Sheila said, obviously relieved at the turn in the conversation.
Klutz out on patrol, near Castle View, according to his last 10-20.
Okay. Polly's face, suffused with alien anger, tried to swim to the surface of his mind. He forced it back and concentrated on Hugh Priest again. But for one terrible second, he could see no faces at all, only an awful blankness.
Alan, you there, 10-4?
Yes, you bet. Call Klutz and tell him to get on over to Hugh Priest's house near the end of Castle Hill Road. He'll know where. I imagine Hugh's at work, but if he does happen to be taking the day off, I'll want Klutz to pick him up and bring him in for questioning. 10-4?
10-4, Alan.
Tell him to proceed with extreme caution. Tell him Hugh is wanted for questioning in the deaths of Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jurczyk. He should be able to fill in the rest of the blanks for himself. 10-4.
Oh!
Sheila sounded both alarmed and excited. 10-4, Sheriff. I'm on my way to the town motor pool. I expect to find Hugh there. 10-40 over and out. As he racked the mic, it felt as if he had been holding it for at least 4 years. He thought, if you told Polly what you just put on the air to Sheila, this situation you've got on your hands might be a little less nasty. Or it might not. How could he tell such a thing when he didn't know what the situation was? Polly had accused him of prying, of snooping. That covered a lot of territory, none of it mapped. Besides, there was something else. Telling the dispatcher to put out a pick-up and hold was part of what the job was all about. So was making sure your field officers knew that the man they were after might be dangerous. Giving out the same information to your girlfriend on an open radio telephone patch was a different matter entirely. He had done the right thing, and he knew it. This did not quiet the ache in his heart, however, and he made another effort to focus his mind on the business ahead. Finding Hugh Priest, bringing him in, getting him a goddamn lawyer if he wanted one, and then asking him why he had stuck a corkscrew into Nettie's dog, Raider. For a moment it worked, but as he started the station wagon's engine and pulled away from the curb, it was still Polly's face, not Hugh's, he saw behind his eyes. At about the same time Alan was heading across town to arrest Hugh Priest, Henry Beaufort was standing in his driveway and looking at his Thunderbird. The note he'd found under the windshield wiper was in one hand. The damage the chicken shit bastard had done to the tires was bad, but the tires could be replaced. It was the scratch he had drawn along the car's right-hand side that really toasted Henry's ass. He looked at the note again and read it aloud. Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog. Who had he cut off lately? Oh, all kinds of people. A night when he didn't have to cut someone off was a rare night indeed. But cut off and car keys kept on the board behind the bar? Only one of those just lately. Only one. You motherfucker, the Mellow Tiger's owner and operator said in a soft, reflective voice. You stupid, crazy, motherfucking son of a bitch. He thought about going back inside to get his deer rifle and then thought better of it. The Tiger was just up the road, and he kept a rather special box under the bar. Inside it was a double-barreled Winchester shotgun sawed off at the knees. He'd kept it there ever since that numb fuck Ace Merrill had tried to rob him a few years back. It was a highly illegal weapon, and Henry had never used it. He thought he might just use it today. He touched the ugly scratch Hugh had laid into the side of his T-Bird, then crumpled up the note and tossed it aside. Billy Tupper would be up at the Tiger by now, sweeping the floor and swamping out the heads. Henry would get the sod off, then borrow Billy's Pontiac. It seemed he had a little asshole hunting to do. Henry kicked the balled-up note into the grass. You've been taking those stupid pills again, Hugh, but you aren't going to be taking any more after today. I guarantee it. He touched the scratch a final time. He had never been so angry in his whole life. I guarantee it. Henry set off up the road toward the Mellow Tiger, walking fast. In the process of tearing apart George T. Nelson's bedroom, Frank Jewett found half an ounce of coke under the mattress of the double bed.
He flushed it down the john, and as he watched it swirl away, he felt a sudden cramp in his belly. He started to unbuckle his pants, then walked back into the trashed bedroom again instead. Frank supposed he had gone utterly crazy, but he no longer cared much. Crazy people did not have to think about the future. To crazy people, the future was a very low priority. One of the few undisturbed things in George T. Nelson's bedroom was a picture on the wall. It was a picture of an old lady. It was in an expensive gold frame, and this suggested to Frank that it was a picture of George T. Nelson's sainted mother. The cramp struck again. Frank removed the picture from the wall and put it on the floor. Then he unbuckled his pants, squatted carefully above it, and did what came naturally. It was the high point of what had been, up till then, a very bad day. Lenny Partridge, Castle Rock's oldest resident and holder of the Boston Post cane, which Aunt Evie Chalmers had once possessed, also drove one of Castle Rock's oldest cars. It was a 1966 Chevrolet Bel Air, which had once been white. It was now a generic smudged no-color, call it dirt road gray. It wasn't in very good shape. The glass in the back window had been replaced by a flapping sheet of all-weather plastic some years ago. The rocker panels had rusted out so badly that Lenny could view the road through a complicated lacework of rust as he drove along, and the exhaust pipe hung down like the rotted arm of a man who had died in a dry climate. Also, the oil seals were gone. When Lenny drove the Bel Air, he spread great clouds of fragrant blue smoke out behind him, and the fields he passed on his daily trip into town looked as if a homicidal aviator had just dusted them with paraquat. The Chevy gobbled 3, sometimes 4, quarts of oil a day. This gaudy consumption did not bother Lenny in the least. He bought recycled diamond motor oil from Sonny Jacket in the 5-gallon economy size, and he always made sure that Sonny deducted 10%, his golden ager discount. And because he hadn't driven the Bel Air at a speed greater than 35 miles an hour in the last 10 years, it would probably hold together longer than Lenny himself. While Henry Beaufort was starting up the road to the Mellow Tiger on the other side of the Tin Bridge, almost 5 miles away, Lenny was guiding his rusty Bel Air over the top of Castle Hill. There was a man standing in the middle of the road with his arms held up in an imperial stop gesture. The man was bare-chested and barefooted. He wore only a pair of khaki pants with the fly unzipped, and around his neck a moth-eaten runner of fur. Lenny's heart took a large, wheezy leap in his scrawny chest, and he slammed both of his feet, clad in a pair of slowly disintegrating high tops, down on the brake pedal. It sank almost to the floor with an unearthly moan, and the Bel Air finally stopped less than 3 feet from the man in the road, whom Lenny now recognized as Hugh Priest. Hugh had not so much as flinched. When the car stopped, he strode rapidly around to where Lenny was sitting, hands pressed against the front of his thermal undershirt, trying to catch his breath and wondering if this was the final cardiac arrest.
"Hugh," he gasped. "Why, what in the town of hell are you doing, boy? I almost run you down. I..."
Hugh opened the driver's door and leaned in. The fur stole he was wearing around his neck swung forward, and Lenny flinched back from it. It looked like a half-rotten foxtail with great hunks of fur missing from the hide. It smelled bad. Hugh seized him by the straps of his overalls and hauled him out of the car. Lenny uttered a squawk of terror and outrage.
"Sorry, old-timer," Hugh said in the absent voice of a man who has much greater problems than this one on his mind. "I need your car. Mine's a little under the weather."
"You can't!"
But Hugh most definitely could. He tossed Lenny across the road as if the old fellow were no more than a bag of rags. When Lenny came down, there was a clear snapping sound, and his squawks turned to mournful, hooting cries of pain. He had broken one collarbone and 2 ribs. Ignoring him, Hugh got behind the wheel of the Chevy, pulled the door shut, and floored the accelerator. The engine let out a scream of surprise, and a blue fog of oil smoke rolled out of the sagging tailpipe. He was rolling down the hill at better than 50 miles an hour before Lenny Partridge could even manage to thrash his way over onto his back. Andy Clutterbuck swung onto Castle Hill Road at approximately 3:35 p.m. He passed Lenny Partridge's old oil guzzler going the other way and didn't give it a thought. Clut's mind was totally occupied with Hugh Priest, and the rusty old Bel Air was just another part of the scenery. Clut didn't have the slightest idea of why or how Hugh might have been involved in the deaths of Wilma and Nettie, but that was all right. He was a foot soldier, and that was all. The whys and hows were someone else's job, and this was one of those days when he was damn glad of it. He did know that Hugh was a nasty drunk whom the years had not sweetened. A man like that might do anything, especially when he was deep in his cups. And he's probably at work anyway, Clut thought, but as he approached the ramshackle house which Hugh called home, he unsnapped the strap on his service revolver just the same. A moment later, he saw the sun twinkling off glass and chrome in Hugh's driveway, and his nerves cranked up until they were humming like telephone wires in a gale. Hugh's car was here, and when a man's car was at home, the man usually was, too. It was just a fact of country life. When Hugh had left his driveway on foot, he had turned right, away from town and toward the top of Castle Hill. If Clut had looked in that direction, he would have seen Lenny Partridge lying on the soft shoulder of the road and flopping around like a chicken taking a dust bath, but he didn't look that way. All of Clut's attention was focused on Hugh's house. Lenny's thin, bird-like cries went in one of Clut's ears, directly across his brain without raising the slightest alarm, and out the other. Clut drew his gun before getting out of the cruiser. William Tupper was only 19, and he was never going to be a Rhodes Scholar, but he was smart enough to be terrified by Henry's behavior when Henry came into the empty bar at 4:20 on the last real day of Castle Rock's existence. He was also smart enough to know trying to refuse Henry the keys to his Pontiac would do no good. In his present mood, Henry, who was, under ordinary circumstances, the best boss Billy had ever had, would just knock him down and take them. So for the first, and perhaps the only, time in his life, Billy tried guile. "Henry," he said timidly, "you look like you could use a drink. I know I could. Why don't you let me pour us both a short one before you go?" Henry had disappeared behind the bar. Billy could hear him back there, rummaging around and cursing under his breath. Finally he stood up again, holding a rectangular wooden box with a small padlock on it. He put the box on the bar and began to pick through the ring of keys he wore at his belt. He considered what Billy had said, began to shake his head, then reconsidered. A drink really wasn't such a bad idea. It would settle both his hands and his nerves. He found the right key, popped the lock on the box, and laid the lock aside on the bar. "Okay," he said, "but if we're going to do it, let's do it right. Cheevas, single for you, double for me." He pointed his finger at Billy. Billy flinched. He was suddenly sure Henry was going to add, "But you're coming with me. And don't tell your mother I let you have hard liquor in here. Do you understand me?" "Yes, sir," Billy said, relieved. He went quickly to get the bottle before Henry could change his mind. "I understand you perfect." Deke Bradford, the man who ran Castle Rock's biggest and most expensive operation, Public Works, was utterly disgusted. "Nope, he's not here," he told Allen. "Hasn't been in all day. But if you see him before I do, do me a favor and tell him he's fired." "Why have you held on to him as long as you have, Deke?" They were standing in the hot afternoon sunlight outside Town Garage Number 1. Off to the left, a Case Construction and Supply truck was backed up to a shed. Three men were offloading small but heavy wooden cases. A red diamond shape, the symbol for high explosives, was stenciled on each of these. From inside the shed, Allen could hear the whisper of air conditioning. It seemed very odd to hear an air conditioner running this late in the year, but in Castle Rock this had been an extremely odd week. "I kept on longer than I should," Deke admitted, and ran his hands through his short, graying hair. "I did it because I thought there was a good man hiding somewhere inside of him." Deke was one of those short, stocky men, fireplugs with legs, who always looked ready to take a large chomp out of someone's ass. He was, however, one of the sweetest, kindest men Allen had ever met. "When he wasn't drunk or too hungover, wasn't nobody in this town work harder for you than Hugh would? And there was something in his face made me think he might not be one of those men who just has to go on drinking until the devil knocks him down. I thought maybe with a steady job he'd straighten up and fly right. But this last week..." "What about this last week?" "Man's been going to hell in a handbasket. Looked like he was all the time on something, and I don't necessarily mean booze. It seemed like his eyes sank way back in his head, and he was always looking over your shoulder when you talked to him, never right at you. Also, he started talking to himself." "About what?" "I don't know. I doubt if the other guys do either. I hate to fire a man, but I'd made up my mind on Hugh even before you pulled in here this afternoon. I'm done with him." "Excuse me, Deke." Allen went back to the car, called Sheila, and told her Hugh hadn't been at work all day.
See if you can reach Clutch, Sheila, and tell him to really watch his ass and send John out there as a backup. He hesitated over the next part, knowing the caution had resulted in more than a few needless shootings, and then went ahead. He had to. He owed it to the officers in the field. Clut and John are to consider Hugh armed and dangerous. Got it? Armed and dangerous, 10-4. Okay, 10-40, Unit 1 out. He racked the microphone and walked back to Deke. Do you think he might have left town, Deke? Him? Deke cocked his head to one side and spat tobacco juice. Guys like him never leave town until they've picked up their last paycheck. Most of them never leave at all. When it comes to remembering what roads lead out of town, guys like you seem to have some sort of forgetting disease. Something caught Deke's eye, and he turned toward the men offloading the wooden crates. Watch what you're doing with those, you guys. You're supposed to be unloading them, not playing pepper with them. That's a lot of bang you got there, Alan said. Hey, 20 cases. We're going to blow a granite jar top over at the gravel pit out on number 5. The way it looks to me, we'll have enough left over to blow Hugh all the way to Mars if you want to. Why did you get so much? It wasn't my idea. Buster added to my purchase order. God knows why. I can tell you one thing, though. He's going to shit when he sees the electrical bill for this month, unless a cold front moves in. That air conditioner sucks up the juice something wicked, but you got to keep that stuff cool or it sweats. They all tell you this new bang don't do it, but I believe in better safe than sorry. Buster topped your order, Alan mused. Yeah, by 4 or 6 cases. I can't remember which. Wonders will never cease, huh? I guess not. Deke, can I use your office phone? Be my guest. Alan sat behind Deke's desk for a full minute, sweating dark patches beneath the arms of his uniform shirt and listening to the telephone at Polly's house ring again and again and again. At last, he dropped the handset back into the cradle. He left the office in a slow walk, head down. Deke was padlocking the door of the dynamite shack, and when he turned to Alan, his face was long and unhappy. There was a good man somewhere inside of Hugh Priest, Alan. I swear to God there was. A lot of times, that man comes out. I've seen it happen before. More often than most people would believe. With Hugh? He shrugged. Uh-uh. No soap. Alan nodded. Are you okay, Alan? You look like you come over funny. I'm fine, Alan said, smiling a little. But it was the truth. He had come over funny. Polly, too. And Hugh. And Brian Rusk. It seemed as if everyone had come over funny today. Want a glass of water or cold tea? I got some. Thanks, but I better get going. All right, let me know how it turns out. That was something Alan couldn't promise to do, but he had a sickening little feeling in the pit of his stomach that Deke would be able to read all about it for himself in a day or two, or watch it on TV. I'll see you, Deke, was all he said. Lenny Partridge's old Chevy Bel Air pulled into one of the slant parking spaces in front of Needful Things shortly before 4, and the man of the hour got out. Hugh's fly was still unzipped, and he was still wearing the foxtail around his neck. He crossed the sidewalk, his bare feet slapping on the hot concrete, and opened the door. The small silver bell overhead jingled. The only person who saw him go in was Charlie Fortin. He was standing in the doorway of the Western Auto and smoking one of his stinky home-rolled cigarettes. Old Hugh finally flipped, Charlie said to no one in particular. Inside, Mr. Gaunt looked at old Hugh with a pleasant, expectant little smile, as if barefooted, bare-chested men wearing moth-eaten foxtails around their necks showed up in his shop every day. He made a small check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. The last check mark. I'm in trouble, Hugh said, advancing on Mr. Gaunt. His eyes rolled from side to side in their sockets like pinballs. I'm in a real mess this time. I know, Mr. Gaunt said in his most soothing voice. This seemed like the right place to come. I don't know. I keep dreaming about you. I didn't know where else to turn. This is the right place, Hugh. He cut my tires, Hugh whispered. Beaufort, the bastard who owns the Mellow Tiger. He left a note. You'll know what I'll come after next time, Hubert, it said. I know what that means. You bet I do. One of Hugh's grubby and large-fingered hands caressed the mangy fur, and an expression of adoration spread across his face. It would have been sappy if it had not been so clearly genuine. My beautiful, beautiful foxtail. Perhaps you ought to take care of him, Mr. Gaunt suggested thoughtfully, before he can take care of you. I know that sounds a little, well, extreme, but when you consider...
Yeah, yes, that's just what I want to do.
I think I have just the thing, Mr. Gaunt said. He bent down, and when he straightened up, he had an automatic pistol in his left hand. He pushed it across the glass top of the case, fully loaded. Hugh picked it up. His confusion seemed to blow away like smoke as the gun's solid weight filled his hand. He could smell gun grease, low and fragrant.
I left my wallet at home, he said.
Oh, you don't need to worry about that, Mr. Gaunt told him. At Needful Things, Hugh, we insure the things we sell. Suddenly his face hardened. His lips peeled back from his teeth and his eyes blazed. Go get him, he cried in a low, harsh voice. Go get the bastard that wants to destroy what is yours. Go get him, Hugh. Protect yourself. Protect your property. Hugh grinned suddenly. Thanks, Mr. Gaunt. Thanks a lot. Don't mention it, Mr. Gaunt said, dropping immediately back into his normal tone of voice. But the small silver bell was already jangling as Hugh went back out, stuffing the automatic into the sagging waistband of his trousers as he walked. Mr. Gaunt went to the window and watched Hugh get behind the wheel of the tired Chevy and back it into the street. A Budweiser truck rolling slowly down Main Street blared its horn and swerved to avoid him. Go get him, Hugh, Mr. Gaunt said in a low voice. Small wisps of smoke began to rise from his ears and his hair. Thicker threads emerged from his nostrils and from between the square white tombstones of his teeth. Get all of them you can. Party down, big fella. Mr. Gaunt threw back his head and began to laugh. John LaPointe hurried toward the side door of the sheriff's office, the one that gave on the municipal building parking lot. He was excited, armed and dangerous. It wasn't often you got to assist in arresting an armed and dangerous suspect, not in a sleepy little town like Castle Rock, anyway. He had forgotten all about his missing wallet, at least for the time being, and Sally Ratcliffe was even further from his mind. He reached for the door just as someone opened it from the other side. All at once, John was facing 220 pounds of angry phys ed coach. Just the man I wanted to see, Lester Pratt said in his new, soft and silky voice. He held up a black leather wallet. Lose something, you ugly, two-timing, gambling, godless son of a bitch? John didn't have the slightest idea what Lester Pratt was doing here, or how he could have found his lost wallet. He only knew that he was Klutz's designated backup, and he had to get going right away. Whatever it is, I'll talk to you about it later, Lester, John said, and reached for his wallet. When Lester first pulled it back out of his reach and then brought it down hard, smacking John in the center of the face with it, he was more astounded than angry. Oh, I don't want to talk, Lester said in his new soft and silky voice. I wouldn't waste my time. He dropped the wallet, grabbed John by the shoulders, picked him up, and threw him back into the sheriff's office. Deputy LaPointe flew 6 feet through the air and landed on top of Norris Ridgewick's desk. His butt skated across it, plowing a path through the heaped paperwork and knocking Norris's in-out basket onto the floor. John followed, landing on his back with a painful thump. Sheila Brigham was staring through the dispatcher's window, her mouth wide open. John began to pick himself up. He was shaken and dazed, without the slightest clue as to what was going on here. Lester was walking toward him in a fighting strut. His fists were held up in an old-fashioned John L. Sullivan pose that should have been comic, but wasn't. I'm going to learn you a lesson, Lester said in his new soft and silky voice. I'm going to teach you what happens to Catholic fellows who steal Baptist fellows' girls. I'm going to teach you all about it, and when I'm done, you'll have it so right you'll never forget it. Lester Pratt closed in to teaching distance. Billy Tupper might not have been an intellectual, but he was a sympathetic ear, and a sympathetic ear was the best medicine for Henry Beaufort's rage that afternoon. Henry drank his drink and told Billy what had happened, and as he talked, he felt himself calming down. It occurred to him that if he had gotten the shotgun and just kept rolling, he might have ended this day not behind his bar, but behind those of the holding cell in the sheriff's office. He loved his T-Bird a lot, but he began to realize he didn't love it enough to go to prison for it. He could replace the tires, and the scratch down the side would eventually buff out. As for Hugh Priest, let the law take care of him. He finished the drink and stood up.
You still going after him, Mr. Beaufort? Billy asked apprehensively.
I wouldn't waste my time, Henry said, and Billy breathed a sigh of relief. I'm going to let Alan Pangborn take care of him. Isn't that what I pay my taxes for, Billy?
I guess so.
Billy looked out the window and brightened a little more. A rusty old car, a car which had once been white but was now a faded no-color, call it dirt road gray, was coming up the hill toward the Mellow Tiger, spreading a thick blue fog of exhaust behind it.
Look, it's old Lenny. I ain't seen him in a coon's age.
Well, we still don't open until 5, Henry said. He went behind the bar to use the telephone. The box containing the sawed-off shotgun was still on the bar. I think I was planning to use that, he mused. I think I really was. What the hell gets into people? Some kind of poison?
Billy walked toward the door as Lenny's old car pulled into the parking lot.
Lester, John LaPointe began, and that was when a fist almost as large as a daisy-canned ham, but much harder, collided with the center of his face. There was a dirty crunching sound as his nose broke in a burst of horrible pain. John's eyes squeezed shut, and brightly colored sparks of light fountained up in the darkness. He went reeling and flailing across the room, waving his arms, fighting a losing battle to stay on his feet. Blood was pouring out of his nose and over his mouth. He struck the bulletin board and knocked it off the wall. Lester began to walk toward him again, his brow wrinkled into a beetling frown of concentration below his screaming haircut. In the dispatcher's office, Sheila got on the radio and began trying to get Alan. Frank Jewett was on the verge of leaving the home of his good old friend, George T. Nelson, when he had a sudden cautionary thought. This thought was that, when George T. Nelson arrived home to find his bedroom trashed, his coke flushed, and the likeness of his mother beshitted, he might come looking for his old party buddy. Frank decided it would be nuts to leave without finishing what he had started. And if finishing what he had started meant blowing the blackmailing bastard's head off, so be it. There was a gun cabinet downstairs, and the idea of doing the job with one of George T. Nelson's own guns felt like poetic justice to Frank. If he was unable to unlock the gun cabinet or force the door, he would help himself to one of his old party buddy's steak knives and do the job with that. He would stand behind the front door, and when George T. Nelson came in, Frank would either blow his motherfucking head off or grab him by the hair and cut his motherfucking throat. The gun would probably be the safer of the two options, but the more Frank thought of the hot blood jetting from George T. Nelson's slit neck and splashing all over his hands, the more fitting it seemed. Et tu, Georgie. Et tu, you blackmailing fuck. Frank's reflections were disturbed at this point by George T. Nelson's parakeet, Tammy Faye, who had picked the most inauspicious moment of its small avian life to burst into song. As Frank listened, a peculiar and terribly unpleasant smile began to surface on his face. How did I miss that goddamn bird the first time? He asked himself as he strode into the kitchen. He found the drawer with the sharp knives in it after a little exploration and spent the next 15 minutes poking it through the bars of Tammy Faye's cage, forcing the small bird into a fluttery, feather-shedding panic before growing bored with the game and skewering it. Then he went downstairs to see what he could do about the gun cabinet. The lock turned out to be a snap, and as Frank climbed the stairs to the first floor again, he burst into an unseasonal but nonetheless cheery song. Oh, you better not fight, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows if you've been bad or good. So you better be good for goodness sake. Frank, who had never failed to watch Lawrence Welk every Saturday night with his own beloved mother, sang the last line in a low Larry Hooper basso. Gosh, he felt good. How could he have ever believed, only an hour or so earlier, that his life was at an end? This wasn't the end. It was the beginning. Out with the old, especially dear old friends like George T. Nelson, and in with the new. Frank settled in behind the door. He was pretty well loaded for bear. There was a Winchester shotgun leaning against the wall, a Lama 32 automatic stuffed into his belt, and an upraised Sheffington steak knife in his hand. From where he stood, he could see the small heap of yellow feathers that had been Tammy Faye.
A small grin twitched Frank's Mr. Weatherby mouth, and his eyes, utterly mad eyes now, rolled ceaselessly back and forth behind his round, rimless Mr. Weatherby spectacles.
"You better be good for goodness sake," he admonished under his breath.
He sang this line several times as he stood there, and several more times after he had made himself more comfortable, sitting behind the door with his legs crossed, his back propped against the wall, and his weapons in his lap. He began to feel alarmed at how sleepy he was becoming. It seemed nuts to be on the verge of dozing off when he was waiting to cut a man's throat, but that didn't change the fact. He thought he had read someplace, perhaps in one of his classes at the University of Maine at Farmington, a cow college from which he had graduated with absolutely no honors at all, that a severe shock to the nervous system sometimes had that very effect, and he'd suffered a severe shock, all right. It was a wonder his heart hadn't blown like an old tire when he saw those magazines scattered all over his office. Frank decided it would be unwise to take chances. He moved George T. Nelson's long, oatmeal-colored sofa away from the wall a little bit, crawled behind it, and lay down on his back with the shotgun by his left hand. His right hand, still curled around the handle of the steak knife, lay on his chest. There. Much better. George T. Nelson's deep pile carpeting was actually quite comfortable.
"You better be good, for goodness sake," Frank sang under his breath.
He was still singing in a low, snory voice 10 minutes later, when he finally dozed off.
"Unit 1!"
Sheila screamed from the radio slung under the dash as Alan crossed the tin bridge on his way back into town.
"Come in, Unit 1! Come in right now!"
Alan felt a sickening lift drop in his stomach. Clut had run into a hornet's nest up at Hugh Priest's house on Castle Hill Road. He was sure of it. Why in Christ's name hadn't he told Clut to rendezvous with John before bracing Hugh? You know why, because not all your attention was on your job when you were giving orders. If something's happened to Clut because of that, you'll have to face it and own the part of it that's yours. But that comes later. Your job right now is to do your job. So do it, Alan. Forget about Polly and do your damn job. He snatched the microphone off its prongs.
"Unit 1, come back. Someone's beating John up," she screamed. "Come quick, Alan. He's hurting him bad."
This information was so completely at odds with what Alan had expected that he was utterly flummoxed for a moment.
"What? Who? There? Hurry up! He's killing him!"
All at once it clicked home. It was Hugh Priest, of course. For some reason, Hugh had come to the sheriff's office, had arrived before John could get rolling for Castle Hill, and had started swinging. It was John LaPointe, not Andy Clutterbuck, who was in danger. Alan grabbed the dash flash, turned it on, and stuck it to the roof. When he reached the town side of the bridge, he offered the old station wagon a silent apology and floored the accelerator. Clut began to suspect Hugh wasn't home when he saw that all the tires on the man's car were not just flat, but cut to pieces. He was about to approach the house anyway when he finally heard thin cries for help. He stood where he was for a moment, undecided, then hurried back down the driveway. This time he saw Lenny lying on the side of the road and ran, holster flapping, to where the old man lay.
"Help me!" Lenny wheezed as Clut knelt by him. "Hugh Priest's gone crazy. Tunnel fools busted me right to Christ up."
"Where you hurt, Lenny?" Clut asked. He touched the old man's shoulder. Lenny let out a shriek. It was as good an answer as any. Clut stood up, unsure of exactly what to do next. Too many things had gotten crammed up in his mind. All he knew for sure was that he desperately did not want to fuck this up. "Don't move," he said at last. "I'm going to call medical assistance."
"I ain't got no plans to get up and do the tango, you goddamn fool," Lenny said.
He was crying and snarling with pain. He looked like an old bloodhound with a broken leg. "Right," Clut said. He started to run back to his cruiser, then returned to Lenny again. "He took your car, right?"
"No,"
Lenny gasped, holding his hands against his broken ribs. "He busted me up, then flew off on a magic fucking carpet.
Sure he took my car. Why do you think I'm laying here? Get a fucking tan?"
"Right," Clut repeated, and sprinted back down the road. Dimes and quarters bounced out of his pockets and spun across the macadam in bright little arcs. He leaned in the window of his car so fast he almost knocked himself out on the door ledge. He snagged the mic. He had to get Sheila to send help for the old man, but that wasn't the most important thing. Both Alan and the state police had to know that Hugh Priest was now driving Lenny Partridge's old Chevrolet Bel Air.
Clut wasn't sure what year it was, but nobody could miss that dust-colored oil burner. But he could not raise Sheila in dispatch. He tried three times, and there was no answer. No answer at all. Now he could hear Lenny starting to scream again, and Clut went into Hugh's house to call rescue services in Norway on the telephone. One hell of a fine time for Sheila to have to use the John, he thought. Henry Beaufort was also trying to reach the sheriff's office. He stood against the bar with the telephone pressed against his ear. It rang again and again and again. Come on, he said. Answer the fucking phone. What are you guys doing over there, playing gin rummy? Billy Tupper had gone outside. Henry heard him yell something and looked up impatiently. The yell was followed by a sudden loud bang. Henry's first thought was that one of Lenny's old tires had blown, and then there were two more bangs. Billy walked back into the Tiger. He was walking very slowly. He was holding one hand against his throat, and blood was pouring through his fingers.
Henry!
Billy cried in a weird, strangled, cockney voice.
Henry! And...
He reached the Rockola, stood there swaying for a moment, and then everything in his body seemed to let go at once, and he collapsed in a loose tumble. A shadow fell over his feet, which were almost out the door, and then the shadow's owner appeared. He was wearing a foxtail around his neck and holding a pistol in one hand. Smoke drifted from its barrel. Tiny jewels of perspiration nestled in the sparse mat of hair between his nipples. The skin under his eyes was puffy and brown. He stepped over Billy Tupper and into the dimness of the Mellow Tiger. Hello, Henry, said Hugh Priest. John LaPointe didn't know why this was happening, but he knew that Lester was going to kill him if he kept it up, and Lester showed no sign of even slowing down, let alone stopping. He tried to slide down the wall and out of Lester's reach, but Lester grabbed his shirt and yanked him back up. Lester was still breathing easily. His own shirt had not even come untucked from the elastic waistband of his sweatpants. Here you go, Johnny boy, Lester said, and smashed another fist into John's upper lip. John felt it split apart on his teeth. Grow your goddamn pussy tickler over that. Blindly, John stuck out one leg behind Lester and pushed as hard as he could. Lester uttered a surprised yell and went over, but he shot both hands out as he toppled, snagged them in John's blood-spattered shirt, and pulled the deputy over on top of him. They began to roll across the floor, butting and punching. Both were far too busy to see Sheila Brigham dart out of the dispatcher's cubicle and into Allen's office. She snatched the shotgun off the wall, cocked it, and ran back into the bullpen area, which was now a shambles. Lester was sitting on top of John, industriously banging his head against the floor. Sheila knew how to use the gun she held. She had been target shooting since she was 8 years old. Now she socked the butt plate against her shoulder and screamed, "Get away from him, John! Give me a clear field!" Lester turned at the sound of her voice, his eyes glaring. He bared his teeth at Sheila like an angry bull gorilla, then went back to banging John's head on the floor. As Allen approached the municipal building, he saw the first unqualifyingly good thing of the day, Norris Ridgewick's VW, approaching from the other direction. Norris was in plain clothes, but Allen cared not at all about that. He could use him this afternoon. Oh, boy, how he could use him. Then that went to hell, too. A large red car, a Cadillac, license plate Keaton 1, suddenly shot out of the narrow alley which gave access to the municipal building's parking lot. Allen watched, gape-mouthed, as Buster drove his Cadillac into the side of Norris's Beetle. The caddy wasn't going fast, but it was roughly four times the size of Norris's car. There was a crunch of crimping metal, and the VW toppled over onto the passenger side with a hollow bang and a brisk tinkle of glass. Allen slammed on the brakes and got out of his station wagon. Buster was getting out of his Cadillac. Norris was struggling out through the window of his Volkswagen with a dazed expression on his face. Buster began to stalk toward Norris, his hands closing into fists. A frozen grin was rising on his fat, round face. Allen took one look at that grin and began to run. The first shot Hugh fired shattered a bottle of Wild Turkey on the back bar. The second shattered the glass over a framed document which hung on the wall just above Henry's head and left a round black hole in the liquor license beneath. The third tore off Henry Beaufort's right cheek in a pink cloud of blood and vaporized flesh. Henry shrieked, grabbed the box with the sawed-off shotgun inside, and dropped behind the bar. He knew Hugh had shot him, but he didn't know if it was bad or not. He was only aware that the right side of his face was suddenly as hot as a furnace, and that blood, warm, wet, and sticky, was pouring down the side of his neck.
"Let's talk about cars, Henry," Hugh was saying as he approached the bar. "Even better than that, let's talk about my foxtail. What do you say?"
Henry opened the box. It was lined with red velvet. He stuck his jittery, unstable hands in and pulled out the sawed-off Winchester. He started to break it, then realized there was no time. He would just have to hope it was loaded. He gathered his legs under him, getting ready to spring up and give Hugh what he sincerely hoped would be a big surprise. Sheila realized John wasn't going to get out from under the crazy man, who she now believed was Lester Platt, or Pratt, the gym teacher at the high school anyway. She didn't think John could get out from under. Lester had stopped banging John's head against the floor and had closed his big hands around John's throat instead. Sheila reversed the gun, locked her hands on the barrel, and cocked it back over her shoulder like Ted Williams. Then she brought it around in a hard, smooth swing. Lester turned his head at the last moment, just in time to catch the gun's steel-edged walnut stock between his eyes. There was a nasty crunch as the gun stock smashed a hole into Lester's skull and turned his forebrain to jelly. It sounded as if someone had stepped very hard on a full box of popcorn. Lester Pratt was dead before he hit the floor. Sheila Brigham looked at him and began to scream.
"Did you think I wouldn't know who it was?"
Buster Keaton was grunting as he dragged Norris, who was dazed but unhurt, the rest of the way out of the VW's driver's side window.
"Did you think I wouldn't know with your name right at the bottom of every goddamn sheet of paper you taped up? Did you? Did you?"
He cocked one fist back to strike Norris, and Alan Pangborn slipped a handcuff around it as neatly as you please.
"Huh!"
Buster exclaimed, and wheeled ponderously around. Inside the municipal building, someone started to scream. Alan glanced in that direction, then used the cuff on the other end of the chain to pull Buster over to the open door of his own Cadillac. Buster flailed at him as he did so. Alan took several punches.